morning, everybody. Matt Bubala with your 720 WGN. Thanks for staying up even later with us. It's 1:11 a.m. Hey, Roger Badish.
Well, hello, Matt Bubala.
I accidentally turned off the TV that your picture's on. I'm going to have to get that working again.
My TV? Oh, that picture.
Yeah, yeah, I can't see you in the newsroom right now.
Oh, is it like completely gone? Or what did you do?
I was switching the channels because they've always got like weird infomercials or things on. So I tried to put on the news channels in case something happens in the middle of the night.
What would that be?
I don't know.
I know.
Kind of a crazy week.
Well, we've got all
this
the channels going on in here. So.
Okay, so you'll let us know if something's going on?
Yes, I will. I definitely will.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's been a busy week in many ways, on many levels. I did take your advice.
Oh.
Yep. Remember we talked last week about the pizza.
I wasn't drunk when I said this, was I? Oh, okay.
Well, I don't know. You're in a different room, so
exactly.
I can't.
That's
I didn't
true.
Do a breathalyzer.
That's true.
You know.
Yeah, they don't give me like something to blow into before I can turn the mic on. That's probably a good idea. They should have that.
They should.
Just like they have for cars, you have to blow into this before you're allowed to turn the mic on.
Yeah, they should have like a straight line on the carpet in there so you can walk it and see. You know, Jess could verify that
for you.
They
used to have that at the Loop back in the day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, probably.
Well, I have...
you took my advice.
I took your advice, and instead of purchasing pizza...
Yes.
For us on Saturday morning, which I still feel...
Wait, you've been buying pizza both nights every weekend?
Well, this is Saturday morning.
Oh.
Technically. Okay. Friday night, Saturday morning.
Yes, it is Saturday morning.
Yeah.
You're right.
Per your instructions...
Yes.
Because you're the boss.
Yes. Yes! I like where this is going.
I took the money and then some.
Because you have to explain to people, you won some money this week. Golfing.
Yes.
Big dollars.
Big bucks,
like,
baby.
Like $3 whole, I think. I read.
More than I've ever had in my life.
Look out.
Yeah. So I took that and added $97 to it.
Ooh.
And put it over into our savings account.
There you go.
To try to save money for our grand girls to go to
Disney trip.
Or as I have been told now by several Disney aficionados, like those who have visited the parks quite often. Somebody even said that their parents have like the top tier family pass or something like that, like, you know, that gets you into all the secret places.
Sure.
So they have said that they claim Disney World would be the better of the two as opposed to Disneyland. Now, I've been to Disneyland.
Yes, you definitely want to go to Disney World instead.
Okay, all right.
And I've never been to Disneyland, so I shouldn't speak out of turn necessarily on that. But as I understand it, Disneyland, much smaller, original scope, whole blah, blah, blah. Disney World got Epcot, got the whole, I forget what other. There's like, you know, they got the safari whatever park, and they've got a whole... movie thing. I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah.
A lot to do.
If you want to be a traditionalist, Disneyland, and Bridget and I went there with some friends in California back when we lived in Vegas.
Yeah.
And Bridget was 9 months pregnant on a
day.
Well,
that's the best time you should take somebody to drag themselves around a park all day long. Absolutely.
On a day that was about 110 degrees with an air quality warning
alert. It was orange in the air.
Yes.
But we got through it.
Yeah, I had fun.
I don't remember her walking around a lot, but I think she sat.
But, yeah, so and didn't see everything, obviously, in one day. You can't see everything in one day. But we went up for just a day excursion, and we drove back in the evening. But it was fun. You know, I actually finally got to go to Disneyland instead of seeing it on TV all these years.
Right.
But so I'm told Disney World, so that's what we're going to shoot for.
Disney World. Plus, if you go to Disney World, and if you stay like for 3 or 4 or 5 days or whatever, you do the parks, but then there's also like a SeaWorld there. There's, I don't know, there's other parks. Like, you know, Orlando is... got a lot
big
to do.
Theme park place.
Yeah, got a lot to do there. So good. So we're $100 into the savings.
We're $100 into the savings.
And what are we estimating that we need for this trip? Like, have we gone about that?
I don't know.
Like,
I have no idea.
Like, what is it?
I have no idea.
It's not going to be cheap.
Well, so the two girls definitely have to have their mom or daughter go along.
Yes.
And if I'm going, then Bridget's got to go.
Yeah, well, of course.
She's going to be, you know.
So there's five of you.
So there's five, three adults, two kids
Yeah.
for a week?
I mean, you could do like 4 days if you wanted to say, because, you know, it's expensive going to the
park. Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying.
And the hotel. So we went one time. We only took the kids one time. And we stayed. It was brand new at the time. And it was right outside of Disney World. There is, because they have hotels on site and then, you know, there's hotels off site.
Right.
We stayed on site because we went, it was our family and our kids and Colleen's brother and his kids. And, God, it's something Bay. There were brand new buildings at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They're part of like the Disney Club, but you could also just rent, rent rooms. And so we got like a family suite that had two bedrooms and a big living room so we could all be there. And it had like a little kitchen.
Sure.
So, Colleen's brother had driven down. We flew. And so they went and they bought groceries for the week. So we had like breakfast and one other meal there every day to save money.
Okay.
And it also had balconies. And so every night, because the triplets were really young, we'd get back there, and at 9 o'clock, they do fireworks every single night. And from our balcony, we could watch them. It was perfect.
Oh, man.
So you could look into ways you guys could all stay together and save money and different things like that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I'm thinking, all right, if I do 100 a week instead of buying pizza, that's 5,200 in eight. By next year at this time, that's not going to be enough.
Probably not, but it'll be somewhat close, I would think.
All right.
I mean, it depends on when you go, because you guys would fly, right? Not going to drive all the
way. Yeah, no, So
there,
that takes too long.
I mean, $5,200 might get you 4 days as far as the park passes and hotel. Maybe not. I don't even know.
Matt,
it's been a while. Yeah. Yes, Jess.
Can I start a GoFundMe page for Roger?
Oh, no, no, no,
don't
no,
think
no,
we can.
No, 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 no. Thank you for the thought, but no.
Very thoughtful.
No. We'll
just keep buying the pizza so Roger can save the money. How about that?
Okay. Yeah.
We'll do that.
Matt also promised to get pizza today too, Roger.
Yeah, I'm back to buying pizza. I gave Jess the credit card. So, you know who you need to talk to, though, is Marlene Wells.
Oh.
Marlene has been to Disney like 1,000 times.
Really?
Yes.
So another resource now.
Her and Mr. Wells go all the time, and they love it, and she's been there, so she could tell you everything, best ways to do things, I'm quite sure.
That's going to be awesome. I definitely.
And when we went, and this is a long time ago now, so I'm sure things have changed, but if they still have these fast passes, you totally have to spring for the fast passes because there's like a line you could wait in for something for an hour and a half.
Right.
Or you could have a fast pass where you go into a line where you only wait like 10 minutes.
Well, I like that.
And so that helps you like get through the day and get to see things and get to go, you know.
Well, yeah.
Do a lot more.
I don't want to like see like only two things in one day because I got to stand in line. Yeah. I'd like to.
Totally.
Yeah. Okay.
My guess is also if you go like in August when it's, you know, the seventh ring of hell down there, that it's going to be a lot cheaper and the crowds will be less.
Just a tad humid?
That's my guess. Yes. I can't even remember when we went. I think we went like in February. So I think it was over a break.
How is it, do you think, around like Christmas time?
Insanity, I'm sure.
Really? Oh. Everybody's trying to get there, I guess.
I think, you know, there's time, because it's also a big international destination.
True.
So yeah. I think that, my guess is at times like Christmas, it's going to be very expensive. Kids are off of school, things like that.
I don't want to take them out of school to go, because I always resented that when I was teaching. You know, kids would come in 2 weeks late. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm late. We were on vacation. I'm like, no.
I understand that, but how old are the girls?
Fifth grade and third grade.
So say you go in 2 years and they're in seventh grade and fifth grade. Is missing 4 days of school really going to change? And I know as a teacher, I understand it.
Yeah.
But the life experience and memories and all that stuff so far outweighs a couple of days of school.
And I want to do it sooner rather than later.
Well, you got to do it before they're kind of out of the Disney.
Well, not just that, but, you know, knock on wood. You know, Bridget and I have been through a lot over the last 4 years, but I'd like to do it sooner than later so that we both get a chance to enjoy it with them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know. Absolutely.
So, all right. Well, I've got a lot more investigating to do and more planning and more everything. And so we'll update you from time to time.
Good. Roger.
Yes.
I expect an update by next show.
Update next of weekend. What? Like that I have $200 in the savings account?
Jess is going to start a tote board that we're going to just check into every weekend. We'll throw up and then we'll do a big drum roll and then a reveal, and it's out $200!
In the Baddish Bank.
Yes.
There you go.
815 says, for five people, about $2,000 a person for a week. So you need about $10,000.
All-inclusive flights, hotels.
I'm guessing that doesn't include the flights.
It doesn't.
That's my guess. They also write, I highly suggest staying on the property, buying a park hopper, and the photo package. Park hopper. That means you have passes to all the parks.
Oh.
Because there's Disney World, there's Epcot, there's... well, Disney World is the all-inclusive. So I guess Magic Kingdom is like the Disney part. Then there's the Disney Safari or whatever it's called. There's Epcot. And then there's one more that I think is more like their Hollywood Studios thing.
Oh, okay.
Which was by
Marvel and all that stuff. Yeah,
If that's a Disney property. I know they have a huge Pixar thing there.
Yeah.
They
own Marvel now, so.
They do. You'll get all that.
Okay.
You'd probably just stay there the whole week and let the kids walk around elsewhere.
Wow, this is, okay. All right. I may start putting more in each week.
Well, there you go.
Well, if I can, I mean, you know, we'll work on it. We'll see. I got to do this soon. Now I'm really.
See, now you got something to shoot for. Isn't that exciting?
Well, it just, you got me. You got me last week, so.
Yeah. Good. Excellent. Okay, so it's 1:22 in the morning. We're going to take a quick break. Coming up in just a few minutes, I used to work in Detroit for a very short amount of time with a gentleman named Danny Bonaducci. And you know him from the Partridge Family. And as an adult, radio star here in Chicago and reality TV star and all these things. And he married a wonderful woman named Gretchen, who became Gretchen Bonaducci when his radio career was starting out, when he was at kind of a crazy point in his life. And I knew them both in Detroit. I actually spent a night with Gretchen in Detroit. That doesn't mean what you think it means, but, you know.
Is that another story?
It's a story I'll ask her about. I wonder if she even remembers. I don't know that she will, because she's had a crazy life with Danny. I don't know that she even remembers that she spent a night with me once, but we'll find out. And she'll tell us about her life with Danny Bonaducci. She says this is her chance to tell her side of the story, because Danny's had radio shows for years and told stories about Gretchen and everything else crazy in his life. And we'll see what she has to say about her life now and her years with Danny Bonaducci. The book's called Surviving Agent Orange and Other Things I Learned from Being Thrown Under the Partridge Family Bus. So we'll chat with Gretchen here in a little bit. Sonya Von Meter, I'm hoping, is going to join us. She's a political opposition researcher. Quite a week in Washington, D.C. this week between the Kavanaugh hearings and the anonymous op-ed piece and everything else. So we want to chat about that. Robert Bartholomew, our friend who talks about mass hysteria and this whole thing with what really happened in Cuba. There's a New York Times story this week that says microwave weapons are the prime suspect. That maybe there really was something being worked on. So we've got a lot of stuff to do. Your calls and texts as well. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on 720 WGN. Roger 714 says California's Disneyland is the best. 870 says, Roger, finish your book so I can buy it. Every dollar counts. So there you go. Got to keep working on that book, too, Roger. Gretchen Bonaducci with us after the news. We're going to play a little bit of President Obama throughout the show. A little later in the show, we'll play some cuts from the speech he gave at U of I on Friday. And it was so interesting because I miss President Obama. I definitely do. I miss his eloquence. I miss hearing him talk. I miss the presidentialness of the office that we just aren't seeing in the current administration. But it was weird to hear him. I didn't think he would actually come right out and say President Trump and talk about him directly. I thought he was going to just remain out of the fray. And so really, President Obama is coming back, not just as an ex-president, but as somebody who's going to get back involved in politics, at least for this election cycle, try to drum up money and try to bring out the vote. And that was just very interesting. And I wonder how well that's going to help Democrats. To me, and we'll ask Sonya Van Meter about this when she jumps on the phone with us, to me, there is this wave, there is this insurgent wave of people upset with Trump that is going to bring out a lot of votes. And generally, any president has trouble retaining control. President Obama lost control of the House and Senate. I believe President Bush, George W. did. I believe President Clinton did early on, right? Generally, we don't stay with all houses, all branches of Congress and the administration under the same party. We have, you know, we have an inherent system of checks and balances that we seem to end up voting for all the time. So I think things were bound to change. And I don't know if President Obama getting too heavily involved helps that. Because as much as Democrats love President Obama, we're all already there. And I feel like President Obama could give more ammunition to President Trump to come out and attack and drum up his supporters and say, you don't want to go back to 8 years of that, to this, and then finding, you know, everything he can as a problem with the administration, with Obama's administration. I don't know. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how President Obama plays it and how that plays overall in the country. And you know, I don't blame Democrats for wanting him out there because they, you know, I think are abandoning Hillary. I know she was called an albatross candidate earlier tonight. I don't know if that is the case or not. I think, you know, like they said, after 8 years, things tend to change. It's rare in my lifetime that a party holds on for 12 whole years, as they did after President Reagan and President Bush, his vice president, became president. I don't know if Biden would have been a better candidate, and I don't know that Bernie Sanders, everybody like say, oh, Bernie would have won. Well, if there's one thing we learned from the last election, it's that the polling is not always right. So saying, oh, everything shows Bernie would have won, you can't go by that, because everything shows that Trump was not going to win. Yet he did. All right, 1:30 in the morning. Let's check the news headlines. Here's Roger. 1:34 in the morning, 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you. That's the Partridge Family theme song that has been played, I imagine, over and over and over again in her lifetime. Gretchen Bonaducci joins us on the phone. Good morning, Gretchen.
Good morning. Oh, my gosh. I'm so excited to be talking to you and talking to my people in my hometown.
Yep. Did you grow up in Chicago, Gretchen? Were you born and raised in Chicago for a while?
I was born in Waukegan and lived in Zion, yep, and in and out of Chicago for many years. Many. So it is my hometown, though. I mean, you know, North Chicago, and then there's Waukegan. So when I tell anyone, where are you from, I'm like, I'm from Chicago.
Gretchen Bonaducci, the ex-wife of Danny Bonaducci. Her book is Surviving Agent Orange and Other Things I Learned from Being Thrown Under the Partridge Family Bus. And Gretchen, this is great for me because I have not spoken to you in, I think, 21 years.
I know. I was listening to you guys talking about Disneyland and you saying that we slept together one night in Detroit.
I did not say that we slept together. I said
no.
I spent the night with Gretchen.
Yes, you did say that.
Do you have any recollection of that?
No, I don't. Oh, my gosh, I'm so embarrassed.
No,
like, that's terrible.
So, Gretchen, I was Danny's producer for about 6 months. In Detroit at WKQI, Q95, at Q95,
yeah.
I was Danny's producer. Right after you guys moved there, I got hired. I was only there for about 6 months. Mr. Wirt fired me, which was, I've always told people, it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And so when I first moved there, you guys had just moved there. Danny, it was Halloween weekend, so it was soon after, I think, you guys had moved there full time. Danny
I totally remember now, yes, because I was worried because, you know, in Detroit, a lot of times they have, I forgot what the night's called. There's like a specific night that they refer to, and I was kind of afraid to be there by myself, and yes, I totally remember now.
So Danny asked me, I just moved to Detroit literally like a week or so before I start producing on the show, and Danny's like, I got to go out of town because he was doing an appearance somewhere. And he's like, I don't want Gretchen and Isabella to be there by themselves. We just moved to town, and Halloween could be crazy here. So I spent the weekend at your house with you.
I totally remember now. Yes. Oh, and that was an unbelievably sweet and kind of you to do that. Like, who would do that? Who would just go, okay, yeah, in case your family gets murdered, I will be there to protect them.
I'll take the first hit, and then, you know, I'll just be here with you as that all happens. Yes. Well, Danny was not an easy person. Not that I would have said no, but, like, Danny is a force. Danny has always been a force of nature in that he is very like, he fills up a room, and he's, I think you would imagine he's hard to say no to. That probably got him in a lot of trouble in his life, that people tend to say yes to Danny a lot, right?
Oh, I think that's incredibly true. And, you know, I always wondered what people thought about that, you know, were working with him, because I didn't know, you know, I thought he was kind of difficult, but I didn't know if people that were working with him were like, this guy's difficult. You know?
I always told people, people would ask, you know, cause you know, you always heard stories, especially at that time. There were a lot of stories about Danny being crazy because there were a lot of crazy things in the news with him over the years. Right. And so when people would ask,
you think?
When people would ask what it was like to work with Danny, I would say he is your best friend and your worst enemy, sometimes in the same 60 minutes.
And you know, especially when you're married to him, that is exactly what I would say, too. Sometimes he was my best friend, and sometimes, a lot of the time, he was my worst enemy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, like, there were times that Danny was ready to kill me, and you know, I was fired just 6 months into the job, and I think that was pretty much Danny saying, you know, hey, this isn't working out, whatever, and that was fine. But, like, you know, 2 weeks before, he was being offered a contract in New York and was talking to me about getting me written into the contract. So it was like, you know, this roller coaster with Danny. And I imagine that was your life for a lot of years of marriage, just lots of really cool highs and lots of really tough lows.
It is exactly what it was. I mean, it was either really, really great or really, really terrible. There was like no in between whatsoever. So you experienced my marriage exactly. So I think we're on the same page with that one.
So tell everybody, anybody that doesn't know. So you and it was a very famous courtship that, of course, Danny told the story many times over the years on the radio. But tell everybody about you and Danny met, and I want to say it was 8 hours later you guys got married.
Well, that is right? That is the famous lore, but that's not exactly true. I think it was more like 48 hours, but the Star did an article, Star magazine, that said Danny Bonaducci marries Blonde after 8 hour courtship. So that became the story. But and not that it makes it any better that it was 48 hours, except for the fact that we were married 18 years. So
yeah,
it kind of made it pretty far.
We did.
And, you know, like you said, there was so many great, great things, and then there was so many bad, bad things, and just no in between, you know. And eventually when it was more bad, bad things than great, great things, that's when you finally have to go, okay, this isn't working.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But he's a handful, not going to lie. But he's had radio shows for years to say whatever about me, and some of it's true, some of it's not true, but I kind of felt like I wanted to represent myself. You know, I wanted to tell my story, which was the whole reason I wanted to write a book. You know, I felt like a lot of people didn't like me because of the things he had said. And I'm like, you know what? I don't accept your hate. Read my book. And if you still hate me, then I accept. But, you know, I'm not going to let anyone not like me over things that may be true or may not be true. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I think the tough part is whenever somebody's a celebrity in the way that Danny has been later in life with radio shows, and I think Danny really followed kind of the Howard Stern mold of, I'm just going to let it all out there. I'm going to, the warts and all, and that's how, you know, we're going to, you know, really connect with people, and that's fine. But like you said, there are embellishments sometimes. It's an 8 hour courtship, not a 2 day, because it sounds a little better. And so Danny, you know, is an entertainer. And so, so I think sometimes things got drawn out a little more, and because it was funnier and things like that. And so, you know, as the spouse, you take the brunt of that. And I imagine there's times that that's really hard.
Yeah, I mean, it was, but the thing with him, and, you know, because you know him, you probably really get it, with me in particular, he always just put me on such a pedestal, you know, like was always my wife, she's so great, and, you know, I'm not going to lie, I kind of enjoyed being that person,
sure.
But that was kind of a hard thing to live up to, although I do think it definitely made me a better person, because I think I was so worried about disappointing him because he, you know, was saying all these great things about me that I wanted to be that good, you know? So it kind of helped me as a human being to try to, you know, just be a better person. So that was good, you know? Like, I feel like when we were married, I was probably at my peak of being the best person I could be, you know, because I had no room to just, you know, fall off the pedestal. Like, I really had to maintain that because I never wanted to disappoint him or anyone around him who was, you know, looking at me going, oh my God, she's so great. She's so wonderful, you know, and I wanted to be that person.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's hard for anyone to live up to. And let's face it, marriage is difficult as it is. No marriage is easy. And to make it 18 years with somebody who's in the limelight and who's, and Danny used to say he was bipolar. Is Danny bipolar?
Oh, definitely. Okay. Yeah, for
so,
sure.
So bipolar, had addiction issues. Yeah,
and, yeah. Yes. he had a lot of steroids. There was a lot of things that I had to deal with. But the weird thing was, is, I mean, it's not weird. I think it's probably pretty universal to people that have addiction problems. Mm-hmm. He would be great. And then for like 6 months, 8 months, all good. And then he'd crash. And then it would be really bad. And then he would get it together. So, you know, there were a lot of times where everything was great, you know, before. I'd say every 6 months we had a big bump in the road. That just became where I had to kind of go, if I don't leave now, I'm going to be in this exact position in 6 months, you know, where he's misbehaving. And now my children were older, and I really wanted to not put them in that position, yeah. You know, where they, it's just not good for kids.
Yeah.
You know, that was the thing that made me go, was watching Dr. Phil. And I was watching an episode, and he said, children would rather be from a bad situation than in one. And I was like, oh my God, I'm keeping my children in a bad situation. And, you know, for me, I'm an adult, I can choose to fight for something, but to put my kids in that, I just kind of had to deal with, was probably not the best thing for them.
Yeah. So there wasn't one episode. It was just the repetitive over and over ups and downs that finally made you say this just isn't healthy anymore.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, there was a lot of infidelity, and that was hard for me to catch until computers and texting, you know, because when I thought something was going wrong and I would confront him about it, it was like, oh, you're crazy. I would never do that to you. And then you turn on the radio, it's like, I love my wife. She's made, you know what I mean? Like, he was selling me that line as much as every radio station he was on. And up until I could actually catch him doing these things, you know, I wasn't going to leave my marriage over something I thought was happening. Sure. I needed to know for sure, yeah. You know.
Mm-hmm. And so finally that time came and you said, okay, this is...
Yeah, no, when I finally caught him and there was no getting around it, I finally had to try to address it because, you know, we were a family, we had two kids, and I wanted to keep things together, but I kind of knew at that point, after trying for like a year or two after that, that it just was not fixable.
Yeah. How long? So what year did you guys end up getting divorced?
I think it was 2009 or 2010 when it was, finally through. We were married 18 years total to the day, which was weird because...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we filed like 2 years before it was final, and it ended up coming through on the day we got married. So to the day, we were married 18 years. And you know, so much of it was great and crazy. And, I mean, I traveled the world and just met a lot of great people. Yeah, like I'm so grateful, you know, that I had the opportunity to be married to him and have two amazing children. Our daughter's about to get married in October.
Oh.
And our son is a senior in high school, and it was just a crazy ride, and you know, that's why I wanted to write the book and sort of share my story.
Yeah.
You know, right now I'm sort of trying to push it into a movie because I think it's sort of a Bridget Jones Diary, Only True, kind of mixed with I, Tonya, you know, like with all the absurd situations. So now that I've got the book out there, which took a long, long time, you know, people I don't think understand how hard it is to get a book out there.
Yeah.
You know, you have to write it, and then you have to hopefully get a lit agent, and then that takes a year to, in my case, essentially get all no's. You know, everybody's like, sure. No. And then I ended up with this great company that ended up publishing the book, and I think that was a year and a half to 2 years after I signed before we finally were able to get it out. But everything happens in the time it's supposed to. You know, like now my son's in boarding school. It's in this amazing performing arts school that he was able to get into. And so I have the luxury of going all over the country and doing book signings and all these things that I would not have been able to do had it been, before now. So it's just been incredible. And like the first day on Amazon, it sold out. Like, I couldn't believe it, you know, because I don't know. I don't have hundreds of thousands of followers like a lot of my friends do. You know, like my friend who wrote the foreword is Adrienne Curry. Do you know who that is?
I know that name, yes.
She was the first ever America's Next Top Model, and she's from Joliet, Illinois. So she was married to Christopher Knight. From the Brady Bunch.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah,
okay,
so we became great friends, and because we had so much in common, you know, we were both married to ex-child stars, we were both from Illinois, and, you know, she's got hundreds of thousands of followers, and I have, you know, like 10. And so I'm like, well, I'll put this book out. I'm going to try to write the best book that I can and make it a good book where it doesn't matter that it's me, you know, like just a book that people would go, oh, this looks interesting. And then they, you know, would read it and then go, oh my God, that's so weird. She was married to that guy, Danny Bonaducci.
Yeah.
So that was sort of my goal in writing the book, that I just was trying to write something that I thought was entertaining and that people would like. And so I hope I did, you know, I don't know. I'm getting good feedback, but you know, that could just be from my friends.
Sure. Well, no, I will say I have been flipping through it this week. It's an entertaining read and covers a lot of the, you know, the crazy ups and downs of your life with Danny. And that's interesting as it is, whether it's Danny or somebody else famous. I mean, just being the spouse of somebody who has all this notoriety and infamy, and you travel town to town. I mean, Danny was getting new shows all the time, and you guys were moving around a lot. I mean, just in the 6 months I was with him, it was all over the place. And I can't imagine 18 years of that and the stories that you have and things like that. Now, are you and Danny on speaking terms? How are things today with you guys? Because you still have kids, so you're still, you know, you're locked together for the rest of your lives and through these two wonderful kids. So that's got to be difficult to find out how to navigate those waters, I imagine.
Well, we pretty much only talk about anything if it's with the kids, like, you know, our daughter's wedding and planning that, and our son going to school. But he's married now to another woman who I love, and she's sweet, and he's so happy. And, you know, we really just don't have that much to talk about. So, you know, we're not, like, I don't call him and go, hey, Danny, guess what's happening to me today, you know, because he's moved on and is married, and he's great and healthy, and how could I ever be, you know, upset about that. Like, I'm so happy.
Sure, but you've got a book out now that kind of looks, you know, is being marketed a little bit as, here's the tell-all. So is he like, hey? Or is he like,
I know,
nope,
and
that's
fine. I hate that. I hate when people say, did you write a tell-all book? Because to me, that means your intention was mean. You know, like, I'm writing something, a tell-all, to be mean to people, which is not what I was doing at all. You know, I wanted to write a book about my experience and not to be mean to him. And I mean, most of the people that read it are like, I thought you were too nice to him in the book. You know, I tried to be really fair and say a lot of nice things, because there were a lot of nice things, you know, to say. And then, you know, when I was telling something, in my opinion, that's bad, I was kind of just relaying the story, you know, of something he did. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, if you are a person who's worried about your behavior, then you probably shouldn't have done it if you thought somebody was going to talk about it later. I mean, that's my bar.
Sure,
you know,
yeah,
I mean, if I'm with somebody and I just kind of feel like if I won't say it in front of you, I probably shouldn't say it, you know, and that's the way I feel about the things you do in life.
Well, and like you said, Danny's gotten to have his radio shows forever. He told stories about you endlessly, and some were, you know, maybe more untrue than true for the sake of the story and for the radio show. So it's fair that you get to have your turn at the keyboard, if not the mic. So, but I'm wondering then, because Danny can be volatile. Danny can be great. He can be all of these things. So I imagine when you decide you're writing this book, you got to be thinking, what is Danny going to say about this? Is he going to freak out and get mad at me, or is he going to be cool with it?
Well, I kind of feel like he will be upset if it does well. You know, like, I think if it tanks, he's going to just relish in it and just, you know, be happy about it. But yeah, I think if it does well, I think he's not going to be that happy about it. But I have, it's like been crickets, radio silence. I have not heard one thing about it. I know when he first heard about it a couple years ago that I was writing a book, he was really mad about it. So I don't know if his people have said, you know what, I just wouldn't even acknowledge it, and that's the way you should handle it, because I have heard nothing.
He still has a radio show. He should be booking you on his radio show.
I know. Well, I think my book company is hoping he'll do that, because if not, then they'll just book me across the street. But I do know it's precarious for him, and it'll put him in a position where I think he has to be nice to me, because I think Seattle, apparently, whenever he's mean to me there, that's where he is now. People really get mad and write really mean letters to his program director. So,
that's funny.
So I feel like, yes, if I'm on in Seattle on his station, he's going to have to behave. But yeah, I don't know how he feels about it. I mean, my gut is he's hoping it doesn't do well, and that's probably what he's hoping. But, you know, and I don't know. Like I said, I have no idea if people will want to read it, if they'll read it and think, oh, this is entertaining, because that's kind of what I was, like I said, going for.
Yeah.
You know, just writing a book that people would pick up and go, oh, this is cool. Like, so we tried to shoot a really interesting cover so that people would at least pick it up.
Yeah.
You know, and then I had all my friends, like Cherie Curry, who was the lead singer of the Runaways. She wrote something. My friend Susan Olson, you know, that I could bolster it by going, oh, I know these people and I like them, so if they like her, maybe I should read this book.
Well, it's interesting, because I did expect a little more of you know, the cover, and I understand it's marketing and they want to get people to pick up the book, but the title Surviving Agent Orange makes it sound like, oh boy, she's really going to tell some stories here. And you are nice to Danny in the book overall. I mean, you acknowledge he is who he is and this is how he is, and it's a crazy situation.
Yeah.
So.
Well, here's the thing with the title, which I have to explain, because I could see how people could misconstrue that that sounds kind of mean, but really what it was, you probably, or I don't know, maybe you didn't. Did you see our show Breaking Bonaducci on VH1?
I do remember watching it, yes.
Yeah. So we did that show. We had two seasons on VH1, and then we chose not to do a third season because we're like, if we do a third season, we're getting divorced, you know, because whenever the camera was on, he just went crazy, you know, and I was managing him and raising our kids and everything, and I would just be like, Danny, oh my God, you're ruining your career. Stop it. And he just couldn't. Like, whenever the camera was on him, because you know him, he's a performer, you know, and then when you're getting all of this positive reinforcement from producers, like, oh my God, that's crazy. Everybody's going to watch this episode and go, you're crazy. It just kind of amped him up more, you know? So we decided not to do a third season. And in exchange for not doing that, we brought them an idea called I Know My Kid's the Next Child Star. So they ended up optioning that from us instead. And one of the titles that we threw out, you know, for that show was Surviving Agent Orange, because Danny was going to be a judge with these kids. And so my assistant and I just thought that was so funny that it became Danny's code name, like POTUS, you know. Agent Orange is driving up the driveway. Agent Orange is heading to his meeting at William Morris. You know, so if you don't know that that was the context, I could see how you might think that's being mean, but that was totally his code name between me and our assistant.
Well, that makes sense. You know, we've got to go in a second, but I really wish you well with the book. Again, it's called Surviving Agent Orange and Other Things I Learned from Being Thrown Under the Partridge Family Bus. In my short time with you and Danny in Detroit, we got to go to, I think, Disney World to do some shows.
I think so. I know there was some Ohio things. There was like some, there's a big, I can't remember the name of it there, outside of like Cleveland or Cincinnati. There was a big, what is the place in Gurnee outside of Chicago?
Great America?
Yeah, it was something like that. But yeah, I mean, we did a lot of fun things. And oh my God, I cannot believe, because it is totally coming back to me, how amazing you were that you would come and stay with me and Isabella.
Well, Gretchen, I want to know if you remember this story once I tell it. So we go with the show with John and Rebecca. We go down to Disney World and we do a couple shows there. And you were there with Isabella. And you brought, you guys had a nanny, pretty young girl at the time.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And we do a show, and it was really early in the morning, and then we all go out to eat at some property there, at some restaurant or whatever in Disney World. And they had, it's like 10 in the morning, and they have yards of beer that they sell there. So Danny challenges me to drink this entire yard of beer. And tells me he will give me $100 if I do it.
Now, sounds about right.
I'm a 22-year-old producer making no money at all, so I'm like, okay, of course I will. And so at 10 in the morning, he gets this yard of beer, and I have to stand up, and like John and Rebecca and Danny are holding this thing up for me, and people that are in the restaurant and realize Danny Bonaducci's there are like cheering us on. And so like it takes me like, I think, 90 seconds to get this entire thing down, and Danny won't let me finish until the whole thing is done. I get all the way to the end. I finish it. We set it down. The whole place starts cheering. The entire thing... And then the entire thing comes right back out of me.
God, that's right. Oh, my God, I do remember that. That was crazy. And John Heffron, oh, my gosh, he went on to be on, like, top funny comic, whatever
was
that.
Top comic or something. Yeah.
Yeah, he did that. And Rebecca, I think she does radio in, like, Oregon or
Portland,
So, I do remember that. I'm sorry I remember that you blew chunks all over the place.
Including all over your young nanny, who I'm sure probably did not work for you for very much longer. She's probably,
He wasn't happy about her in the first place because, you know, she was really pretty and was like, I don't know if we need this girl in our house.
Probably a good choice. Gretchen Bonaducci, the book is Surviving Agent Orange and Other Things I Learned from Being Thrown Under the Partridge Family Bus. It's so good to talk to you again. Best of luck with the book, and I hope to see a movie in a couple of years.
Oh, thank you. And you know, I'm going to be in Chicago. I'm doing a book signing on Tuesday.
Oh, excellent. Where at? Where at?
Volumes Bookstore in Wicker Park. So I'm there.
One of my best friends owns that bookstore.
Oh my gosh!
Yes,
you better come say hello.
I taught with her in school.
I think it's at 7 o'clock. Yes, so come say hi. It's going to be a lot of fun, and you know what? I'm going to challenge you to drink another one of those beers. we'll relive our whole thing, and then you can sleep over again and have to protect me.
That sounds good. We'll do it all. Yes, we'll relive our youth, Gretchen. That's just what
Let's
we need,
it.
Right?
Yes.
Sounds
yes,
good.
We
all
do.
Right. Everybody come out and see Gretchen Bonaducci on Tuesday in Wicker Park at Volumes Bookstore. We'll mention that again later and give out the address. Thank you so much for being on, Gretchen.
Thank you for having me on, and I love you, Chicago. I can't wait to be home.
Sounds good. Thank you so much. We'll talk again. Gretchen Bonaducci, Surviving Agent Orange is the book. All right, you heard the tone. It's news time. We've got to get there in a minute, but we've got to take a break first. Coming up, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio.
It was won because rather than be bystanders to history, ordinary people fought and marched and mobilized. And built, and yes, voted to make history.
That was President Obama on Friday at the U of I. He gave a speech to, he was getting, I think, an Ethics in Politics Award.
He was getting the Dirksen Award.
What is that?
In government. Everett Dirksen, former congressman from Illinois. I believe that's what it was from my...
It sounds right, but it's some sort of award. And it was kind of a coming out party a little bit for Barack Obama to come out and say, you know, he's saying this is a very important election. And believe me, I've been guilty, as other politicians are, of saying that every time I'm on the ballot. But this really is, as he said, a very important election. And it was just very interesting to hear him come out and take back the national stage for only a day. And not just talk about the country, but talk about very specifically. I don't know why. I was surprised by it. I didn't expect him. I mean, they always bring out politicians to help out, but I don't remember George W. So George W. does his 8 years. because his vice president is Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney's not going to run. So there was nobody. But you know what? Let's see. Joe Biden didn't run either.
No.
But I don't remember, you know, after Obama took office 2 years in, I certainly don't remember George W. out campaigning for midterms. Now, it's a long time ago, so maybe I wouldn't remember it. Mm-hmm. And maybe George W. Didn't leave. I mean, you know, we were mired in a lot of things after W. left office. And and God knows the economy was tanking and things like that. So maybe it wouldn't have benefited the GOP to bring him around at the time. But it just seems... And maybe it just Obama's so young that he's still going to be involved in things. But mostly, presidents seem to kind of head off into the sun. God knows Bill Clinton's still been around, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been politicking for people. But I don't know. It just kind of surprised me to hear President Obama out there doing that. And I don't know if it's going to do well for the Democrats or not. You would think it's going to certainly... He'll raise a lot of money for Democrats, that's for sure. He's a big ticket. But I just will be very curious to see how much he helps in the midterms.
I stand corrected. I want to make sure I correct it. It's the Paul H. Douglas Award for Ethics in Government is the award.
Okay.
Paul Douglas served in the Democratic Party, U.S. Senator from Illinois for 18 years, from 49 to 67. He was known as a liberal politician. He was also a member of the Chicago City Council. Mm. So
and yet still had ethics.
Yep.
That's a joke. Sorry. And there's another boy, the ROM news almost gets forgotten here by the end
of
the
year
because the national
pushed
news
off
has
the
been
front
so
page
big.
So fast.
No kidding. But so President Obama's back out there speaking, and President Trump had quite a week this week. First, we've got all the excerpts leaking out about the Woodward book, and President Trump pushing back on those a lot.
Saying they were all lies.
They're all lies. It's made up. The book is fiction. So then Woodward is producing, like, one of the things he did was showed, here's an actual example of something that was taken off the president's desk. And he had it. It was something about it was going to be sent to the Republic of Korea.
South Korea, I think. It was a trade agreement or something.
A trade agreement he was going to cancel.
Right.
And Cohn, right, just took it off his desk so he wouldn't sign it. And Trump's like, oh, that never happened, blah, blah, blah. I would have fired him so fast. So then Woodward's like, well, here's the actual memo that he took from him.
Wow.
So that's interesting. And then we have this anonymous op-ed in the New York Times. And they were talking about it earlier on Patty's show, and it's interesting. Everybody's got an opinion, and I think everybody should have an opinion on it. But a couple of things on it. One is, a lot of people are saying, you know, gutless and coward, and you should just resign if you're going to do this. You should just resign.
To the person who wrote
the opinion. They're saying, instead of doing these things, you should just stand up. One of the guys on Patty's show was saying he should go in front of Congress and say, this is what's going on. Do something. It's Congress's job to do something. Well, that's a fine argument, but then nothing would get done, right? I mean, nothing would change. If somebody came out and said, hey, we work for him, and we think there's a lot of things he does that are maybe dangerous to the Republic, and we're disagreeing, and so we're changing what he does as best we can... What is the Senate or the House going to do? There's nothing. All they can say is, well, he was elected and he's the president. Is he breaking any laws?
Right.
No. Well, then you have to put up with it.
Right.
There's nothing. So the argument that this person should instead quit and do this, tell Congress to do something, that goes nowhere in my mind. And I understand people saying, well, if you think he's so bad, then you should just quit. Well, yes, you could do that, but I would also understand that this person that works in the administration and makes it sound like there's several of them who all, as we've read about over the last few years, whether it's Fire and Fury or this fear book by Woodward that's coming out now, we've heard all of these stories about what goes on behind the scenes there. And you can understand because he was elected for many reasons, right? By different factions, but overall, Republicans want you know, less taxes, smaller government, conservative principles, all the ideals of the Republican Party. Well, they've got those at least in name, if not in the actual guy there, right? Mm-hmm. So they want that. They want him to nominate Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. They want him to cut taxes. They want all of these certain things. There's other things that came with it that they're like, this is crazy town, and we can't let this happen. I understand that, too. You know, you don't want him starting World War III. You don't want him saying, why don't we just assassinate people? You don't want him saying, why can't we use the nuclear bombs if we have them? All of these things that are like, whoa, dude, you are the president, and this isn't just, you know, fun time. And so that there are adults in the room or people saying, you know, yeah, there's some crazy stuff with Trump, and we try to mitigate it the best we can. I'm glad that that's happening. I'm glad there's somebody to take stuff off his desk when he's too loon tunes.
Yeah, but the argument was made during Patty's show and on social media that the people doing that were not elected to be president.
Okay, and I understand that argument. Like, well, he's a guy like, so no matter what he does, I mean, if you go by that argument, mm-hmm. then no matter what he does, we have to go, well, we elected him. So if he decides we're going to attack Korea, then we just have to go, well, we elected him.
How many other presidents decided they wanted to go not to war, because you need an act of Congress to declare war,
mm-hmm.
but they wanted to do military exercises or send advisors to certain parts of the world and then eventually have to boost the number of soldiers there to maintain peace at the embassy or whatever.
I'm sure there have been a lot, but that's different than no president has ever spoken like this. No president has ever gone off the handle like this. No president has ever threatened people in the same way that we're having here. This is a higher level of everything. And I also don't believe that in other administrations, the same stuff didn't somewhat happen. That people would be like, you know, so taking something off somebody's, listen, if he's taking a paper off of his desk so he doesn't sign it,
mm-hmm.
and then because he did that, it doesn't happen.
Right.
That to me is not, oh, he shouldn't do that, that's the president's will. That is, if he takes it off his desk and then he doesn't even know and it just flits out of his mind and it doesn't happen, then I'm okay with him taking it off his desk. I mean, think about that, Roger. If you had some big piece of something you were going to do and then Bridget just took it away and mm-hmm. you just completely forgot about it.
No, I totally understand that point.
That's crazy. That didn't need to happen.
I totally understand that point. But he's still the president.
Yes, he's
what
the president.
What he needs to do, or what the job that he was elected to do, whether you agree with it or not, is the job he was elected to do. Nobody else was elected to do that job.
Nobody's stopping him from doing his job. If he said,
they're controlling what he is able to do.
Somewhat, but he's still the president. Nobody has got him in a room and saying, no, you can't. We're going to lock you in here until you change your mind. There's no coup going on.
No. There can't be, because it doesn't happen here. Coups don't happen in America.
Not yet. But they could. I mean, let's
no,
not rule
no.
Any-
come on. Come on.
You never know what's going to happen in the world.
No. No,
but
that can't happen here in America.
Roger, I'd never say can't.
But having aides purposely taking documents off of the president's desk, whether he knows they're there or not, whether he remembers if they were there or not, is something you should not be doing, because it is the job of the president to deal with those documents. Now, if you pull the document off the desk because, oh, I got typos on it, Mr. President, I'm
well,
so sorry, or gosh, we just got
work. So he doesn't sign it, and because they know that this guy is going to forget that he wanted this to happen, and if I just take this one paper off his desk, he won't cancel a trade agreement with South
but
Korea.
But it's not against the law for him to forget. It's not against the law for him to do those things that other people disagree with.
It's not against the law for somebody to take a piece of paper off his desk, probably either.
but that person did not have the right to remove that. That was a document for the president's approval, disapproval, signature, no signature. We don't know what he was going to do with that piece of paper. We know that that document was there. We know what that document said, but we don't know what he was going to do with it.
That's fine.
You're not elected to be able to make the unilateral decision of, oops, what if he does sign it? I'm going to pull it. No, you can't. Let him make that decision. He didn't even have a chance to make the decision.
He could have said, hey, where's the paper where I'm canceling the trade agreement with South Korea?
That's not the point.
And then he would have signed it.
That's not the point. The point is he never had the chance to even consider that document. It's not like he's, what have I got on my schedule for Friday, guys? Well, just this one piece of paper here, Mr. President. For the next 24 hours, that's all you have to do is read it. No, that's not what happens. He's got 10 million things on his plate. He's watching Fox and Friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's doing a lot of stuff. Is he focused necessarily on the business of the people? Sometimes, I think. Sometimes not.
Roger.
I don't think there's a single president in the history of the United States.
He's surrounded
that didn't
by people
do that.
He put in their positions.
Correct.
And
just like every other president.
And if they have decided we're going to work around him a little bit because we are kind of scared of some of the things he's doing and we think he's not doing well, I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. And I guarantee you it's happened time and time again in other ways with other presidents.
I agree with you on that.
Where the cabinet and people are like, he can't be doing this. We got to talk him out. We got to figure out how. And if it's as simple as pulling a piece of paper off his desk, then it's as simple as that. And that's how they work around. Anybody in their job that has a job where they don't want to do something that they think their boss is wrong, they try to find ways to convince their boss not to. And listen, when I was in grade school at St. Thomas More, there was a time I took a bunch of warning slips off of a teacher's desk so we wouldn't all face our detentions.
Oh, you're the one. Oh, they've been in touch with me about you.
I'll never be in a presidential cabinet now.
I don't think so.
Although I appear to be eligible for this one. 312-981-7200. I know some calls and texts want to get into it here. Let's do that after the news next. 720 WGN. Matt Bobala with you. 720 WGN. 312-981-7200. Call or text your thoughts on what's going on. My point of the argument, in part, A, is I'm not that upset that people are doing that because I think it gets done. And with this president and how non-standard of a presidency this is, and the people around him, the people he brought in, if they're trying to manipulate him in some way, shape, or form, that's just how it is. We know how he's manipulated by people trying to get things on Fox News because they know he'll see it. By we heard the stories about Hope Hicks controlling what information he got, making sure he didn't see pieces of paper that would set him off or, you know, different things like that. So I'm not as upset as everybody else is about the idea of this. What I am curious about, though, and I'm not upset with the New York Times for publishing it, because if it is somebody in the inner circle writing this, that is interesting and that is news. And I think they should publish it. And I don't think they have to put a name on it. This whole it's national security stuff is ridiculous. I understand, though, that it's going to drive President Trump crazy, as it would anybody. If somebody did this to Obama or Bush or Clinton or Bush or Reagan or Carter, that would drive them insane. That somebody who works for me, who serves at the pleasure of the president, is out publicly saying anonymously, listen, we think he's done some great things. We think the media coverage is unfair, but yes, he's crazy. Yes, he would do things that would hurt our republic, so we're in control. We're making sure he doesn't do anything too crazy. They actually said in the op-ed, there is an adult in the room. Now,
but that adult wasn't elected by the people.
None of the people there are elected. They still have
Correct.
Jobs to do, Roger. I don't care. I'm not going to buy that argument that, oh, they weren't elected, they don't get to decide. There are other people working there who have to talk the president in and out of things all the time.
Correct.
So
why don't they do that directly with him instead of behind his back?
They do. And then they realize they're talking to a brick wall, that he doesn't want to have information, that he won't read the reports, that he goes by his gut. And then they say, okay, I'm just going to take away this paper and see if he even remembers it. And that works. And that's a sadder statement on him than on the person doing it. I'm sorry. So here's the thing, though, about that op-ed. Why write it? I want to know what's the reason for getting it out, because that's what I'm leery of.
Is what do you why, mean?
Well, all right, so let's think about what the reasoning would be to write this op-ed. So all the excerpts were leaking about the Woodward book, and then the president was slamming these and destroying the credibility, trying to destroy the credibility of that. So,
but make the point that the purpose of the book, or at least the tone of the book, indicated there was a recklessness in the White House, in the Oval Office. I think that this is the story that came out from the book, and then the op-ed piece came out. Do you think that the op-ed piece was a direct response to the fear, maybe, that came out of the book?
I don't know. I don't know if the op-ed piece is related to the book at all or not.
Okay.
I think that's impossible for us to know with the silence of the actual writer of it, unless the New York Times will give some reason like that the author allowed to be, here's why I did this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know that the Woodward book excerpts were leaking out, so we know that was out there, and this comes out a few days later. So the timing is interesting, to say the least, but I don't know if they're completely related. But even if they were, why, if you're working in there and doing this, like I understand if you're working in there and you're doing this, why does everybody out here need to know that? Because by releasing that, by saying this,
mm-hmm.
if you're working in there and you know how crazy it is, and you're actually taking pieces of paper off his desk because you're like, oh my God, he can't do this and we can't talk him out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So let me see if I can just hide this from him. If you're doing that stuff, then you know that by doing this, by talking about this and releasing it, you're going to drive him absolutely insane. I mean, they had to have known that the person that wrote it, that what would come out of this is him saying it's not true, him saying the New York Times is a liar, and him saying, who the hell wrote that? And you better find him for me. I mean, he's trying to threaten the New York Times. He's telling the Justice Department to look into it. He's mm-hmm. saying it's a matter of national security. I tweeted earlier this week that I envision a whole lineup of everybody, you know, in his circle
mm-hmm.
stepping forward, and, you know, him having a press conference where he makes every one of them step forward and say, I did not write it, so that at the end he could say, see, New York Times, you're a liar. Nobody wrote that. You made it up. And then he can charge them some more with it, because I don't think anybody's going to just step up and admit to it. So this is now consuming and making that White House even crazier, because how do you do that to somebody? Whether you think he's crazy or not, you're working there and you think that you can help affect change by working there. Because I would say everybody that's like, why didn't they just quit? I can understand where they're like, I'm not quitting,
mm-hmm.
because then he's going to bring in somebody who's not going to help try to stop him from all the insanity. And if he surrounds himself with too many people like Bannon and Stephen Miller and the worst of the worst, then the worst of the worst is actually going to happen. We need to have a few people with who are like, yeah, not everything he does are we going to let wants are we going to let happen. We're going to try to control him a little bit. If he pulls in too many people that are just, you know, then that doesn't help. So I understand why that person's not quitting. But by releasing this, they are causing so much chaos in there. And how much distrust is President Trump now going to have of every single person he comes in contact with? They're not helped by, I understand they're doing it. I don't understand they're releasing it and making that public, because that just makes inside the White House a really tough place to work, I would imagine, for everybody and for President Trump. For him to not trust who around him could be doing this. And of course, everybody's denying it. But I wonder, you know, who does he really trust at this point? Because, you know, people, Omarosa and others, you know, walk out and start doing these things. That's got to be very difficult for him on a day-to-day basis. So him closing himself off even further, not being willing to take advice now because he doesn't know how these people really feel or how they're acting or what they're acting on, that's going to make it even tougher. He's going to go more by his gut. He's not. He's going to not trust certain people. This just makes it worse for the White House and worse for us to have this administration that has people not only doing those things, but then telling the world that they're doing those things, as if us all knowing, oh, there's an adult in the room, makes it all okay. So why release that? What good does that do? Is that to try to, as we come to the midterm, say, hey, it's okay to vote for Republicans. Don't worry. I know there's some parts of this that you don't like, but the tax cuts and these other parts are really good, and we're controlling the rest. Yeah, he's going to tweet, but don't worry. We're not letting any of the craziness happen. What is the point of releasing that? How does that help anything? That's the part I really have a problem with. Like, why would this person who's doing this feel this need to let the public know that it's happening when it's not going to keep happening if you tell the public? Because now President Trump is going to hunker down and I don't know, is he just going to start talking to Ivanka and Jared and not trust anybody else?
Well, has he trusted anyone before this thing came out? I don't think he has. I think he, as he said in his election, even before he decided to run, he said several times that we should be running the government like a business. He wants to run it like a business. And who runs a business other than the employees? But who at the top runs the business? The CEO. They make unilateral decisions. They tell people what to do. This is how he has run his business in the past.
But he's always had some trusted advisors.
But I don't know if I would say that they are advisors. I really don't believe that he truly trusts anyone within his inner circle. This is how he has protected himself over the decades in business. And I think that this is part of his management style in the White House.
You've got to trust someone to say, I mean, you could say I don't trust anybody, but you're still trusting them with something. He's trusting Michael Cohen to make these payments. That burned him. I mean, he must trust Ivanka. He's talked so highly of her. I mean, he's got some people that everybody has to have somebody, whether you say you trust them or not. There's somebody that you turn to bounce things off of, to talk about things. And maybe it's Ivanka. I don't know. Or maybe he truly doesn't trust anybody, but he still has people he has to talk to. All right. I completely blew through the news. This is terrible. We have to do the news.
Somebody whispered in my ear.
Yeah. I thought we did the news.
Well, we've been talking about the news.
We have been talking about things that are in the news, that's for sure. Let's now get the news headlines with Roger Badish. Good morning, everybody. Matt Bobala with you, 720 WGN, 2:45 in the morning. Sheila Dingus from Advocacy for Fairness in Sports has been nice to hold on a little bit. We'll talk to her right after 3 about the NFL concussion settlement and where that's at lately. But we got into all this, so I want to keep talking about it for a little bit because we've got so many people calling to chat with us. Gene is on 720 WGN. Good morning, Gene.
Hi, I am in total agreement with you about the fact that these people who are the adults in the room are playing a very important part in trying to contain this person who they now realize is probably unhinged. What you have to remember, and Roger is right, my son has said, well, you know, he thinks he can run the government like a CEO of a company. What you have to remember is he bankrupted so many times. He cheated so many people. He left others holding the bag to the point that no bank in America would lend him any more money. That's why they went to the Russians. And if you think that people who he has around him should follow his course like robots without brains and go along with something that might happen that would leave our grandchildren sorting through ashes, trying to find the country that we all once loved. There was a person that was part of the team that worked with investigating and keeping track of what Saddam had in Iraq. And there was a very obscure article that was posted. He was an authority on a particular very dangerous chemical that we suspected Saddam had. And he went to Africa, can't remember South Africa, what part of Africa, and he proved that Saddam did not have that ingredient, that the United Nations was being convinced by the Bush administration that he had. And that just went unnoticed. Think of the trillions of dollars that we could have spent on bridges and roads and schools and things that would have made this country so much better. Bush wanted revenge because he didn't think his own father had gone far enough to ruin and take Saddam out.
Gene, I think he wanted revenge. He wanted revenge because 9/11 happened, and they were going to find somebody. And
But Iraq wasn't much of a part of that.
You're right, it wasn't. And they found reasons to convince him that it was.
Right.
So the U.S. was going to exact some revenge somewhere.
Right,
And so I think it was, here's a case of powers that be convincing a president. Otherwise, we talk about pulling things off the desk, things like that. I absolutely believe Cheney and others who wanted war with Iraq were the ones selling President Bush on this is what we need to do. We need to act. We need to show who we are. And they are part of this. And they're this and that and this and that and whatever. And next thing you know, there we are in a war that we probably didn't really need to be into, that history is not looking kindly upon. That's for sure. Gene, thank you so much for the call. I got to get a couple more in here. Robert is in Oak Brook this morning. Hey, Robert, how are you?
Guys, how you doing? Gene, friends of mine in Australia, and Gene just brought up a good point. I did bring up the point about Fast and Furious, 100,000 AK-47s under Obama being given to the cartels in Mexico. Another in our history, okay? My friends in Australia go, Robert, the United States is going nuts. He goes, so the Democrats want him out. He goes, the one thing we haven't heard, and it's a good point, is what are they going to do differently? I mean, Trump was elected because Washington, D.C. is just like Vegas. You give them your money, and you don't know what happens to it once you give it to them. Okay, it's just Washington, D.C. has the elite of the elites.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are the minions. We're just supposed to run around and do whatever they say.
Okay.
So this is what Obama was getting at. Democrats want him out. Then what? This is what my friend was trying to explain to me. Robert, we're worried over here in Australia. They get Trump out, then what? There is no plan laid out of then what. If Trump gets out, then Pence gets in.
Yeah, well, that's why you say that too many people are talking about impeachment. I'm sorry, but you don't hear Democrats really talking about
impeachment. Oh, no. They don't want to impeach him anymore. They want to do the 25th, whatever the hell that is.
Well,
they just want to get him out.
I disagree, Robert. I don't think that the Democrats want to do anything. The Democrats want Trump right where he's at.
Chaos in our country.
Well, not chaos in our country, but
our country is not being run right now because Trump is. Can you imagine you being an owner of a business? I think you own your own business.
Yes.
And everybody every day hates your guts and wants you gone out of that business. At some point, you might go ahead, take over the business. And then if the business goes, that's our country doing that.
Do you think that President Trump really thinks everybody in the business hates him? President Trump is out at rallies where there's thousands of people cheering him on.
I understand
he's not believing that at all.
There's millions of people who hate his guts.
Well, sure, there are, but
our country should be running.
There were millions
more
of people.
Things
there were millions
about all
of
these
people
idiots.
Who hated President Obama's guts too. Every president has that to some extent, and Trump is a bit Teflon on that. And he believes that anybody who doesn't like him is an idiot, and everybody who loves him is right. So I don't think that that's affecting him in that much, and I don't think that the Democrats want him out at all. They want him right where he is, hoping that he is going to help bring Democrats back into office because all this craziness keeps happening and they're playing on it. And it looks like possibly they're going to regain some control here at the midterms. We'll see what really happens. It's going to be a real litmus test for this presidency and see what happens. Do we end up electing a bunch of Democrats to take over? And it looks like very progressive Democrats are taking over. When you look at the woman who won the New York primary and a woman who won up in Boston, all these things, like there's incumbent Democrats, middle of the road, more type Democrats who are being replaced by very progressive Democrats. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. But Democrats are not the ones talking about impeachment. That's for sure. They're not the ones that want him out at all. They want him right where he is for now. Joe's on 720 WGN. Good morning, Joe.
Matt, the last two just evoked a lot of controversy, haven't they?
Well,
you evoked a couple good responses there. Mine is much more simple.
Okay.
And I've talked to you previously, as you might well remember.
Of course.
Listen, Woodward's book is published and written by Woodward.
Sure, Bob Woodward.
So he can say a lot of stuff, and he can be refuted by a lot of the people he's quoted as saying this, that, and the other thing, and they refute it, okay? I am personally just flabbergasted that the New York Times would publish an article with an anonymous anonymous source. It just blows my mind.
I'm not. Why?
Because I think the day of yellow journalism is at its apex right now.
But that's I so disagree with that, Joe, and I really think that is the President Trump trying to label everything as that's going around. That's not yellow journalism. They know who wrote it.
Just, do you think they do? Matt, let me interrupt you.
No, they have talked about it. The gentleman who runs the op-ed board talked about how the whole thing, he gave an interview about how the whole thing went down. He was contacted by an intermediary.
Oh, I missed it. Okay,
person.
So they in fact know.
Yes, he is contacted by an intermediary of the person who wrote it. And then told, would you be interested in this? And they said, we would. So they sent him to it, and they read it over, and very surprised by how well it was written, all these things. And then they then had contact to confirm who the person was, that it was really them, that they really wrote it. And they felt strong enough that this was an inside enough person that this made sense to publish without printing their name. They do absolutely know who it is.
I did not know that. I stand corrected.
Now, I agree with you. If it was like just sent into them and they're not sure who it was and they printed it, yes, that would be terrible. But that's not what they would do. And they
so what's their credentials? What's their criteria for saying this is all valid?
You know,
another person, does he have a lot of credentials with the New York Times from prior exposure, blah, 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 blah. What are his credentials that lead the New York Times to say this is totally believable?
Well, we don't know that. We don't know that. And if they revealed that, that would probably reveal who the person was, and they're not going to reveal that.
Yeah, so, typical journalism, right?
Well, I mean, you protect sources, and you protect people in certain instances, and here's a whistleblower-type thing where if he revealed his name, he said, I'll tell you. You know, listen, everybody does that. President Trump gives speeches on background, and the White House gives press conferences where they tell people, you can't print our names, but here's information. They do that all the time. It's very standard. But so I don't blame them at all for agreeing to not print the name. If that was the, you know, this is how this interview has to go. I will do this as long as my name isn't revealed. We see people on TV give interviews where they black out their face or they change their voice. Certain times, you know, you say, I'll give you this information as long as you don't reveal my name, as long as we trust in the reporters or the New York Times or whoever it is that this is, they know who it is and we trust them. And that's where you have to put your faith. And if you don't, then you're not going to believe in it and have a problem with it. I understand that. But
well, you've revealed one thing to me, Matt, that I did not know before, because the FBI operates the same way. You don't reveal sources and methods, you know.
Yeah.
So that's standard operating procedure. But nevertheless, I do. There's another little tangent here, and I do view it. But gee, that's a new complexion that I hadn't considered before. But if they have an identified source and it's deemed to be totally credible, that's a different side of the story. But I still think it has a little bit of a tinge of national security. Does this guy have security clearance within the government? You know, there's all kinds of questions it also evokes.
Yeah.
If I can throw one more angle onto this now.
Thank you for the call, Joe. Yes, go ahead.
From a journalistic point of view, so this letter has come out, this op-ed piece has come out. It is behooving journalists to now get off their behinds and go in and try to verify, without regard to who the source of the op-ed is, go in and try to verify, even though many have been trying to verify, and there have been reports from those inside the administration to journalists of things happening in the White House. So journalists now need to go out based on this op-ed piece and verify that information with their own sources within the White House. Those who are willing to confirm or deny the information contained in that op-ed piece to the best of their abilities. Obviously, if people don't want to talk to the media, they don't talk to the media. If they do want to talk, then fine, they talk. And as your listener just said, the FBI does it, police do it. A lot of people do this. This is how we find out about misdeeds. This is how we find out about crime. This is why there is a law protecting whistleblowers, because sometimes people that we elect don't necessarily operate faithfully and judiciously, and sometimes we have to find them and call them out. This is what makes a continuing democracy in America. We're able to do this. If it weren't a democracy in some parts of the world, the public would not be able to do this. You would not hear from that person again. So the job of the journalist now is to continue to try to verify the information in this, or if not, then discredit it.
Well, and I think, Roger, that this op-ed was the confirmation, because we've heard all of these things before. Woodward's book is about taking things off people's desk and doing things like this. Fire and Fury was about the chaos in the White House, everything that keeps getting denied. To me, this is the confirmation. Now, I know we don't have a name attached to this. I think those will come down the road as more people leave the White House and report on things that happen there. But to me, this is the confirmation that it is as bad as you're hearing, but we're trying to make it better. Okay, we got to take a quick break and move on. Sheila Dingus will be with us right after the news. Coming up, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. What's the latest with the NFL concussion settlement as we're about to kick off the season this weekend? What's going on? I guess we already kicked it off with the game on Thursday night. But where are we with everything concussion related with the NFL? There's a huge settlement. How are things going? We'll get a report on that next after we chat with Roger. Go ahead, Roger. Thanks for staying up all night with us, everybody. It's 3:10 in the morning. Matt Bubala with you live in the Allstate Skyline Studios at 303 East Wacker here in the heartland of America, Chicago, Illinois. Joining us on the phone right now is Sheila Dingus. She writes for Advocacy for Fairness in Sports. And she wrote an interesting article a couple of weeks ago about the latest with the NFL concussion settlement. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us, Sheila.
Pleasure to join you.
I really appreciate you holding on, too. I'm sorry we were supposed to be on with you half an hour or so ago, and we got kind of caught up in all this craziness going on in our world this week. And so thank you so much for holding on the line. As we kick off the NFL season, we had the first game on Thursday night, and then we have a full schedule going on this weekend. We haven't talked nearly as much lately because it's kind of been pushed out of the headlines with the NFL with all the other things going on about the concussions. And there was so much talk about them a few years ago. And I guess it comes back up anytime a player who's relatively young dies. And we talk about CTE and the concerns about brain injuries. And there was a big settlement with the NFL and players. Can you give me just a little bit of the background on what the settlement was that the NFL reached, and who are the players that are under that settlement?
Okay. Basically, all players that are included in the settlement are those who retired before July 7th, 2014, who did not make a decision to opt out of the settlement. And initially, the first proposed settlement was for $765 million. Judge Brody rejected that settlement, so co-lead class counsel Chris Seeger and the NFL counsel went back to the table, and the NFL said, okay, we'll give you an uncapped settlement, but you've got to give us unlimited audit power over that settlement. So right now, we're seeing the results of that, and there's a lot of PR going out. I was really appalled. You could probably tell from my article, I was appalled because a PR release went out saying $500 million being paid to players, and that does not present a realistic picture of the settlement. Technically, it's correct. Technically, over $500 million in claims have been approved. Only about 55% of that has been actually paid, and the NFL is vigorously opposing most of the claims that are filed.
You write in the article, while Mr. Seeger correctly stated that over $500 million has, quote, already been approved, he failed to point out the discrepancy between approved and paid claims. The latter amount totaling only $281 million in change, or about 55% of the approvals. Despite Mr. Seeger's correct terminology and the ease of verifying this basic information, numerous outlets erroneously reported the approval amount as having already been paid. So $281 million has been paid out. There's about an additional $200 and some million that's been approved. But you're saying that while that's been approved, the NFL can still fight against those claims.
That's correct. Most of the first claims that went in were what's considered pre-effective date claims. Players that had already received diagnosis, deceased players who had been diagnosed with CTE, and so forth. And so those were really the easiest claims, but the NFL opposed those pretty vigorously. A lot, you know, a lot were approved, a lot were not. Of the money that has actually been paid out, about 26% of it went to players with ALS. But players with ALS only represent 1% of the claimants or the claims filed. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of dollars because basically the settlement has already surpassed projections for the entire 65-year term for players who are suffering from that horrible disease.
So you write in the article also, of the 541 notices of approval, which comprise the $500 million figure, 380 of those approvals have resulted in actual compensation to retired players. There are currently 162 claims in audit, which is a combination of claims yet to be approved and audits of approved claims. Of the 141 approved claims that have not yet been paid, 38 have been appealed, and 50 claims appear to be slated for payments in August. So is it 38 claims right now that they are appealing?
More than that. Those are the claims that are actually in audit. This is sort of interesting because I think it ties into the segment you had previously about, you know, leaked material and confidential material. I received a document this week where the NFL has held 23 previously approved claims. These were claims that survived audits, were approved by the claims administrator, appealed by the NFL, reviewed by the special master of the settlement, approved once again, and now the NFL has a hold on those claims and is trying to impose additional regulations on them. And, you know, so anyway, it's, you know, I received that document. It's not on the public docket, but it's from an extremely credible source that I was able to verify. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes that the parties in charge really don't want the public to know.
Okay, so explain to me, though, Sheila, because they paid out about $281 million. It looks like they're going to get well over $500 million with claims that are pending, even though they're fighting some of them. But you write in there, because so now it is an unlimited settlement over the 65-year term, but they can audit and fight against these things at will. That's kind of what they came up with?
Yes.
So you write that attorneys representing players have told you that if everyone who deserved to be approved was, the payouts could exceed $4 billion. So who is not, you know, there's players that are being denied claims in the end that you... Go ahead.
Basically, I think where the confusion lies for the players and to the public, basically. When the settlement was approved, players were told that it did not cover CTE, but it did cover many of the symptoms of CTE, including dementia. And so, and even in the fairness hearing, they said early and mild dementia are covered. But if you look at the CDR scale, the clinical dementia rating, there are six areas that are evaluated. Memory, orientation, judgment, and problem solving are the ones where most players are finding difficulty. But the other three, community affairs, home and hobbies, and personal care, are the ones the NFL is zeroing in on so that you know, that they can deny claims, and they're trying to say that, no, we don't cover mild. You have to be moderate or severe. And to qualify for moderate or severe in the community affairs means that you're not able to go out independently. You know, they're denying claims because a guy drives. It doesn't matter that he gets lost and can only go maybe a couple of miles from his home. I mean, that's a running joke among the retired NFL community. And some guys are afraid to get diagnosed because they don't want to lose their driver's license. But that doesn't mean that they are able to function, you know, in a way that they can earn a living. Just if you think about, you know, President Reagan had Alzheimer's for pretty much his entire second term, and he managed to bluff his way through and continue the presidency. Glenn Campbell performed over 100 concerts after an Alzheimer's diagnosis. So what they're trying to do is say, you know, we're going to pay you, but when you're severely debilitated, but we're not going to pay you until that time, which, of course, will result, the older the player is when he receives payment, the less money he'll get.
Right. Well, what are the parameters they came up with? I mean, this was agreed upon. This was a settlement that was made. Was it handled poorly by the people representing the players?
Yes, and I'm really not sure how much co-lead class counsel knew. He doesn't speak to me. I've spoken to a number of lawyers who were involved, you know, in the early negotiations and who also represent players, and they tell me that they were blindsided, that they were pretty much locked out of the actual negotiations. They believed what they were told. They believed what everyone else was saying. And, you know, when they went to file the claims, they're having to litigate each one of them like an individual lawsuit.
So the NFL is making it difficult to make the settlements, which I guess we're not surprised by, because they're paying an unlimited amount. Once they agreed to an unlimited amount, they had to know, well, that means that they're going to fight these and be pretty stringent. I mean, they have paid out $281 million. Is it all negative, or you think it's just they're touting too much how great they're doing? It's good that they're paying it out, but this is a tougher road than it should be for these players.
I think they misrepresented the players what was covered. They convinced them to enroll for the settlement. 20,000 players enrolled. They trusted what was told to them. They did not opt out. They believed that their symptoms were covered, you know, and now they're being denied, and they don't have any legal options outside of the settlement because they waived those when they, you know, registered for it.
What about the players who opted out who didn't register for it? Are any of them suing the league separately? And what's going on with those?
That's also an interesting story. They are still in the MDL, and in legal circles, opt-out stuck in an MDL after a settlement or an unsettled MDL are sometimes referred to as being in black holes. It's really hard for them to get out of it. You know, technically, they still have their lawsuits. They're still going, but last month, Judge Brody issued what's known as a Lone Pine Order, which affects most of the opt-outs, not all of them. There are a few that have slightly different claims that weren't included, but the majority of opt-outs were affected by this, and they have to submit medical records. As of yet, the NFL has submitted no discovery whatsoever. There was no discovery done in the actual settlement, and the opt-outs were hoping to, you know, receive discovery, have mutual discovery with the NFL. But basically, as it was explained to me by a law professor, a Lone Pine Order is basically a way that a judge can clear her docket of a bunch of cases by circumventing the normal route of, you know, summary judgment motion, which requires a little bit more to take place. So, you know, these guys are supposed to submit their medical records, and then she's going to look at them, but no one knows what she's going to do with them. You know, is she going to say, okay, these guys are sick enough, but these guys are not sick enough? Well, the majority of the guys were not as sick as I, you know, think they should be. No one really knows what's going to happen, but generally, when a Lone Pine Order is issued and an MDL, cases are dismissed. So we're waiting to see what happens there.
What happens, Sheila, to all the players? So you said this is from July 7th, 2014. All the players that have come in the league in the last 3 or 4 years, are they now signing agreements that we understand the risks and we're not, and the NFL is not responsible, or what will happen with them?
No, there have actually been 3 lawsuits against the NFL since the settlement became final. 2 of the players who fought, well, actually, Adrian Robinson Jr. is a deceased player. He committed suicide at age 25, and his parents have filed a lawsuit against the NFL. He both, was cut and died, you know, after the settlement became final, so he's definitely not a class member. And there's another living player, you know, who has recently filed a lawsuit also. And then there's Aaron Hernandez, his estate. And right now his status as a class member is disputed because the attorneys disagree as to when he retired. But all of those have been placed in the MDL, and they're trying to get out. Yesterday, there was an important ruling in the Ninth Circuit for a different lawsuit in which players have accused the NFL of covering up their injuries, over-medicating them with prescription drugs, and then their injuries never heal because they never realize the degree of them, and they wind up with organ damage from, you know, overuse of the drug. So that's a different lawsuit, and it was appealed, and yesterday, or actually Thursday, the Ninth Circuit ruled in favor of the players, but, you know, it was not preempted. So there's going to be some activity on that, and hopefully it will help the opt-outs because, it, you know, some of the legal matters, the preemption argument is relevant to those.
So there's going to be lawsuits for years to come for the NFL to face. And it sounds like that's not going to change just because they've had this class action settlement, whether it's head injuries or other injuries that go along. There's no way for the NFL. You see, it's interesting because I would have assumed they do this whole group. We realize how bad it is now. And maybe we didn't realize the extent of concussions. And now that we have all this additional information about what these cause, I would think that the NFL is in some ways making players just sign like a waiver, like when we go to some dangerous park or do something where we sign a waiver, or like, gosh, when our kids go to a trampoline park now, we got to sign a waiver saying that if they get killed, it's not the place's fault. I'm surprised the NFL isn't trying to come up with some way to have new players coming in the league say, okay, it's a dangerous sport. I might end up with head injuries. That's the risk I'm going to take for these millions of dollars while I can play in the league.
I wouldn't be surprised if that happens, because one thing they are doing is having players sign a Toradol waiver, because Toradol is, you know, one of the medications used to numb pain. You know, if a guy has an ankle sprain and they want to keep him on the field, they're going to numb him up with Toradol or, you know, some other drug, but Toradol seems to be the drug of choice. And so now they're having players sign Toradol waivers, so I wouldn't be surprised at all, you know, if that happens. But I also think that the new helmet rule is more of a litigation strategy than anything else, because the NFL is going to be able to come back and say, you know, after these guys have retired, if they try to file a lawsuit, the NFL is going to say, hey, we tried to protect you. We, you know, initiated a rule. You guys resisted. You know, and so I think they're going to have a strong defense in that regard.
Well, I think maybe it is related to that, but I also would imagine that they are trying to protect the players, because it behooves the league, especially now that they're being tough on concussions, to keep these players playing, and the teams want them on the field. They've changed kickoffs and things like that. It seems like they have tried to limit the injuries, and, you know, people are complaining about it's not football anymore. So the NFL's, I think, maybe litigation is in their minds, but I also think the protection of the players in the long term. I mean, fewer parents are allowing their kids to play football, and there's a lot of things going on with that, I would imagine.
Well, I don't think that anyone in the NFL, any of the owners or Commissioner Goodell or, you know, anyone has malice against the players, but, you know, whatever happens to them is collateral damage as long as the league survives and thrives. One of the underreported stories for decades has been the NFL's war on its retirees. Disability case after disability case after disability case is denied. And every year, whenever a player wins a disability case, they put new rules in to tighten it up so that someone won't rule, you know, won't win, a disability case on the same grounds. Yeah. So it's really, I had no idea of this until I started researching some of the NFL's cases, and that's why I decided to start blogging. I'm like, this is a huge story that's basically untold, but it's really in plain sight. It's on public court dockets. No.
The article is called Please Don't Drink the Kool-Aid. It's on advocacyforfairnessinsports.org. Sheila Dingus, we're running late for the news, so I've got to get going here. But thank you so much for being on the phone with us this morning.
Thank you. Pleasure speaking with you.
It was great to speak with you as well. Again, advocacyforfairnessinsports.org. Sheila Dingus is the author. Please Don't Drink the Kool-Aid, about the NFL concussion settlement. All right, quick break, and then we got the news next here on 720 WGN. Roger, we've been really late for the news all night. I got to stop doing that.
Well, I haven't helped any.
Okay.
You share the blame.
I appreciate that. It's 2:35 in the morning. Let's check some headlines, Mr. Battish. Matt Pabala with you, 720 WGN, 3:41 in the morning, everybody. Thanks for staying up all night with us. We're here until 5 a.m. Then Orion's got your morning show for you, followed by Mike Steven with Outside the Loop Radio. And sweet Lou Manfredini, is Lou live on location as he seems to always be these days, Roger?
I'm not sure. I do know that they have the Misericordia thing on Sunday afternoon. I'm not sure if he is out the building today or if he's inside.
Actually going to make an appearance?
Yeah, well, if he makes an appearance, it'll be the first time in like 3 weeks.
Wow.
Something like that, I think. 2 or 3 weeks.
Lou's been on the road.
He's a busy man.
He's always a busy man. Lou's got a lot of ideas.
Yes,
so
he does.
Keeps him busy.
Yep.
Hey, by the way, we're just talking about the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to, this weekend, Jack, for his birthday, which was back in the summer, and he really got nothing for it, but he has always wanted to go last couple of years. He's really wanted to go to see the Bears play in Green Bay.
Oh.
And the Bears open up this Sunday night football at Lambeau. And I was able to find a friend who found a friend who had tickets. And we were able to buy tickets at face value,
ooh,
which is the greatest thing in the world ever. Nice. And we are going to go up to Lambeau on Sunday.
Look at you.
Yeah. I mean, we have friends that live in Wisconsin. We have had lunch at Lambeau at a restaurant. It's like, Lambeau's not like Soldier Field. It's kind of always open.
Uh-huh.
You know, they have stuff there going on and a pretty cool restaurant. So we ate there once and kind of walked around. But
oh, nice.
It'll be cool to actually see a game there. I'm very excited about that.
When is that again?
This Sunday night.
Oh, okay.
7:20 p.m., I think.
Well, then it's not going to be too cold. It should be
and
nice.
That's why I'm willing to do it. If this was like December, then no.
Yeah.
I'd rather watch it on TV. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, I'd rather watch the NFL on TV. Football, more than any other sport, lends itself very well to television, I think.
I have been ruined with television as far as football goes.
Mm-hmm.
Not so baseball, but football definitely. The last game I went to was a Bears game at Soldier Field, I'd say maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Something like that. And every time, of course, I was way too far away to see half of what was going on the field. But I kept waiting for the replay on my TV set. No, seriously. You expect so much when you sit and watch it on the TV.
You do.
That when you go to the real game, it's like, well, this is not real. I need to change the channel. I need to adjust the reception. And it drives me crazy.
Well, I'm sure in most places, and I think at Soldier Field, the video boards have gotten better. You can see more stuff on replay. The one thing that is cool about going to a game is seeing the stuff you don't see on television, the full field, kind of where all the players are,
yeah,
what happened at other parts of the play. There's certain things that you'll see that you don't get on television, and that's kind of neat.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you're right. It's a lot better generally to watch it on television.
Yeah, baseball I'm fine with because while I did see baseball on TV, I went early enough in my life to Wrigley Field and Comiskey that I was used to being there and seeing everything. Yeah. Now when I watch it on TV, it's like, let's hurry it up.
Well, and baseball, you know, is something that you can attend and enjoy a little more. Because with football, every 30 seconds, now there's another play. With baseball, it's such a long, drawn-out game. And it's so, there's always something happening every 30 seconds or so.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a lot of time to talk to the person next to you, to keep score, to chat.
Yeah. Yeah,
And you can still enjoy the game. Whereas football, you got to be a little more focused at all times, except during the long down times. It's just a different pace. But it'll be fun to drive up there and see it. Now, the person I ended up getting the tickets from is somebody I know that used to live in our town, and now they moved back up to Wisconsin. And he said, now listen, these tickets have been in my family since like 1940.
Whoa.
And I said, so I can't cause trouble up there? Is that what you're saying? He's like, I only sell these to people I know. And if you get kicked out, I'm going to have a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, we promise we'll be good.
Yeah.
Because that is a little bit of a concern, is that, you know, your Bears fans going up into, you know, north of the Cheddar Curtain.
Oh, sure. In the sea of green.
Could get a little rough.
Yeah.
And then the Bears had a big week. They signed Khalil Mack from the Raiders. A big trade there.
That was a good ad, sure.
Looked well. Yeah, theoretically, you'd think that's going to really maybe turn the tide for the Bears.
Yeah,
should be very interesting.
Yeah, I'm excited to see the season.
I think it's either going to be a really good game on Sunday night, or they are going to get killed, and I'm going to be like, oh God, I can't believe we're up here in Green Bay watching this happen.
All right, so the over under on when you take your Bears hat off and stick it inside your jacket?
I would always, if I have a Bears hat on, I don't own a Bears hat.
Oh,
I don't know what I'll be wearing, but I wouldn't take it off necessarily. I mean,
well, I mean, to, like, you know, protect yourself.
No, I'd be embarrassed and ashamed possibly, but I'll still wear it.
All right,
it is what it is. The Bears are, you know, it would be worse if, like, the Bears were really, really good and the Packers weren't, and then suddenly the Packers are killing them,
right?
Then you're like, oh, I'm embarrassed by this. But the Bears aren't supposed to beat the Packers right now, so if the Packers are beating the Bears, whatever.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's not that big of a deal.
Sure.
If the Bears start sticking it to the Packers fans are really going to be upset, though, because the Packers should win that game.
Yeah.
They've got Aaron Rodgers, who signed that ridiculous new contract for an insane amount of money.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Because we really haven't seen the Bears yet this year. Really haven't.
Well, we haven't seen their starters in a few weeks.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Gave them the last 2 weeks off.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that pans out for them.
And they didn't play the whole game 3 weeks ago.
Well, they never play a whole game in the
preseason. All right, but that's what I'm saying. We really haven't seen the true Bears yet.
Yeah, we have no idea what's going to really be happening there. So that'll be interesting.
Good. Well, I hope you have fun.
I hope we do, too. Thank you, Roger.
I'll be working.
It'll be a nice long drive up there.
Yeah.
Well, I'll listen on the way home. Maybe I'll call.
Okay, that'd be good.
We rented A Quiet Place tonight.
A what?
It was a movie, came out
the movie.
six or eight months ago called A Quiet Place.
Yeah.
Have you heard of that one?
No.
It was John Krasinski and Emily Blunt. He directed it. And the basic premise of the movie is they have to stay quiet because there are monsters that can't see, but they hear insanely well. And if you make any noise, they come and just...
Oh, my. Slobber all over you?
So the whole movie, they're just trying to stay silent.
How do you... Why can't they just leave?
Well, it's Earth, and this is what is left of it. It's sort of a post-apocalyptic type situation.
Kind of like a War of the Worlds kind of thing?
It's a little War of the Worlds, Walking Dead-ish, except there's these monsters that we have no idea, you know, what or how. It's just, here's how we're living now.
Okay.
And this is all we can do. It is very War of the Worlds-ish, actually.
Oh, okay.
And so they can't talk at all. There's only like 20, 30, 40 words in the whole script, I think.
Hmm.
They do. It just is like, what? How do they do it? Coincidentally, by plot contrivance, I guess, one of their daughters is deaf. So conveniently, they all know sign language.
Conveniently.
And that's how they communicate with each other throughout most of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But then somebody makes a noise, somebody knocks something over, suddenly here come these monsters.
Don't.
I have these great pictures of the triplets because I made them all. I said it's family night. We all have to watch together.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy's getting, I don't want to watch this. Why do you want me to be scared? He's getting very upset with me. So I took pictures of the triplets on the couch. Yeah. And it's like the hear no evil, see no evil. They've got pillows over their ears, over their eyes, or hands over their ears. It's hilarious.
That's funny. I know Nick grew up with the horror flicks and everything, and I appreciate that genre. I never really got into it for some reason when I was very young. Those kinds of things. I think it was probably because of the Twilight Zone TV shows.
Sure.
And I forgot there was a second one that tried to do Twilight Zone. Oh, Outer Limits.
Sure.
And the weird music and the weird shows, stories they had on. So when I was very young and I would, either my parents were watching it or it happened to be on the TV at the time, even though it was probably past my bedtime, it kind of spooked me a little bit. And so when I would see, not the monster flicks, I was okay with those. Frankenstein, Dracula, that kind of stuff. But the horror flicks, the, you know, jump out of your seat scary stuff, those kind of, I'm still not fond of those.
Yeah. Well, those are the ones that stick with you a little bit.
Well, yeah.
What's your theory on this? Because Colleen and I argue about this.
Huh.
When there's a scary movie that, like, we want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not big into scary movies either, but sometimes there's one that just looks like it's really good or, you know, has a good star in it, or you see a trailer and you're like, wow, that's going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
Colleen would rather watch it in the house when it comes out.
As opposed to a theater.
As opposed to a theater, where I'm like, why wouldn't you rather, if you're going to be scared after this, do you really want to then just be in your house? I would not want to be in my house.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Because then I'm scared and I'm in my house.
Yeah,
I'd
but
rather
if you
go
see
to a
it,
theater, get scared there, and then walk out, kind of readjust to reality, move on, and then, you know, by the time you get back home, I think there's some distance between you and it.
Oh,
whereas
I
you watch
think
it in
that.
Your house, And then you go up to bed and you're thinking, they could be in this house. Maybe they're coming to get me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I would still think that if it had that kind of an impact on you in a movie theater, when you would get to the house, you would be walking delicately into the house, looking around.
You got a point there. If you're coming into a dark house, you'd be a little...
Yeah. Yeah.
As you open the door.
Yeah.
All right. 312-981-7200. Let's take a quick break. A little more movie news. The very interesting thing that the Academy Awards just did, since Roger, what are you a member of, SAG and AFTRA?
Yeah, SAG-AFTRA. Yeah, they combined.
The Academy did something interesting earlier this year where they announced a new picture, mm-hmm. and now, or well, a new award category. And now they've rescinded it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about that next. 720 WGN.
The Chicago White Sox.
The Chicago Blackhawks.
The Northwestern Wildcats.
And the best Bears coverage on 720 WGN Chicago.
WGN Radio conducts a variety of contests throughout the year.
You won!
Contests are void where prohibited by law. Prizes are non-transferable and can't be exchanged for cash.
No!
Winners are responsible for all taxes associated with prizes. WGN Radio may publicize or broadcast winner names or voices.
Yeah.
Winners are ineligible to win within 2 years of receiving prizes over $600 and 60 days for prizes valued less than $600.
I understand.
Employees and their families of
WGN Radio,
Tribune Company, and participating sponsors are disqualified.
What?
Go to WGNRadio.com/contest for complete disclaimers.
Okay.
Take on your day in comfort and style with footwear and apparel from New Balance Chicago. In store now is the updated Fresh Foam Cruise Nubuck shoe that will elevate your everyday look with modern sports style. New Balance carries a huge selection of shoes in hard-to-find styles, from men's up to size 20, women's up to size 13, and widths from AA to 6E. Head to New Balance Chicago in Lincoln Park, Oak Brook Terrace, Orland Park, and Schaumburg to find your perfect fit with all new gear head to toe.
Who doesn't want to get through airport security faster? Well, with TSA PreCheck, I save time and hassle. For just $85 for 5 years, I keep my shoes on my feet, laptop and liquids in my bag, belt firmly buckled, and light jacket on. What do I do with that extra time? Whatever I want. Every time I fly, TSA PreCheck keeps me moving. Sign up is simple. Enroll today at TSA.gov.
You deserve the wedding you've always dreamed of. You deserve natural, unsurpassed beauty, limestone bluffs, cascading waterfalls, complete with a horse-drawn carriage. You deserve all-inclusive, full-service dinner and dancing in a historic reception lodge and relaxation in cozy log cabins. You deserve the magic of White Pines Resort, just 90 minutes west of Chicagoland, nestled in White Pines Forest State Park in Oregon, Illinois. Book your fairy tale wedding today at whitepinesweddings.com. Take a deep breath. You need a break from the chaos of every day. You need cozy cabins, campfires, s'mores, and ghost stories under the stars. You need White Pines Resort in Oregon, Illinois, just 90 minutes west of Chicagoland. Nestled in the heart of White Pines Forest State Park, you'll find relaxation, homestyle cooking, live entertainment, and memories to cherish. Stay in a real log cabin midweek for only $99. Go to whitepinesresort.net and book your escape today.
Plan to attend Misericordia's Family Festival on Sunday, September 9th from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Highlights include a variety of food and drink, children's games, and a live auction with many fabulous prizes. Misericordia is dedicated to providing extraordinary programs for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Located at 6300 North Ridge, free parking is available at S&C Electric at the corner of Devon and Ridge Avenue. Call 773-973-6300 or visit misericordia.org for more information.
I know we meant all good intentions, so pull me closer. Why don't you pull me close? Why don't you come on over? I can't just let you go.
Epo Bala with you here, 720 WGN. Our friend Robert Bartholomew will be on with us after the 4 a.m. news. You remember Robert. We've talked to him a number of times about things over the years, especially with the... with what happened in Cuba, allegedly, at the embassy, and workers that became sick. And Robert explained to us the concept of mass hysteria and times that it's happened throughout our history. Well, now there's a New York Times, and he said that that's what happened there, that it looks like there's no such thing as these sonic weapons or things like that, that this didn't happen. If you look at the data, it doesn't make any sense. But now a New York Times story this week. Headline, microwave weapons are prime suspect in ills of U.S. embassy workers. We'll get into that right after the news. So, Roger, we were saying that the Motion Picture Academy announced earlier this summer, just on August 8th, not that long ago, that they were going to add a new trophy this year for achievement in popular film.
Right.
Basically, their way of saying, the ratings have been slipping, and we need to make sure that people are watching for the movie that they like the best to win an award, is what it kind of sounds like.
Right.
So just a month after they announced that, they now said, we're not going to do that this year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very interesting. In the article I'm reading about it, they talk about, as soon as they announced it, there were a bunch of concerns about it. Like, well, what are the criteria? How does this work? They didn't exactly have that all worked out, it sounds like.
Right.
And then people were saying, well, wait a minute. ABC, who carries the telecast, sounded like they were, so Disney owns ABC, and they might have been pushing for this edition, and that's really beneficial to them because they make the Marvel movies, they make Star Wars movies, they make Pixar movies. So was it because ABC wants this that they're doing this now? And then what happens is Disney already has the Black Panther movie, which they think is going to be nominated. And then there's also this big movie, Star is Born, is coming out.
Another remake.
And so now they're thinking, okay, wait a minute. If these big blockbusters this year are good enough to actually win the actual award, then we're just going to kind of water everything down if we make a separate award. So now they've scrapped it for this year. And it sounds like we don't really know, is this because they weren't exactly sure they wanted to do this award, or is there a little more inside to this than we'd like to think there was? You'd like to think there's some purity in the voting for this. I know there's not.
No.
But you'd like to think there was a little bit.
See, the original thought for this, and this has been going on for decades, how many times you watch the Academy Awards and go, oh, that one Best Picture? I didn't see that. I thought this one was better. And it was always the most popular movie or that garnered the most money at the box office, never even got nominated, for the most part. I mean, there were exceptions over the decades. But for the most part, the most popular movie never got anything. Maybe a special effects award or something.
Because it's not supposed to be about what was most popular. Well,
I understand. I understand. It's for achievement in certain areas. But when you give out an award for Best Picture, that award is kind of iffy as far as who's using what criteria to judge it. So the Best Picture is the only category that all members of SAG-AFTRA are allowed to vote for.
Wait, do SAG-AFTRA vote for the Academy Awards? I thought you have to be a member of the Academy.
You're a member of the Academy, Screen Actors Guild.
I thought you have to be a member of the Academy. I disagree, Roger. You get to vote on the Oscars?
Yeah.
Wait a minute, are you sure?
SAG-AFTRA, well, for actors, you do. As a member of SAG.
You vote for the SAG
Screen
Awards.
Actors Guild, yeah.
Well, that's not the Oscars.
Yes, the Best Actor category.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. I'll bet you $100 million.
I don't have that. I'm saving it up for a trip to Disney.
The SAG Awards are what you vote on. You have to be a member of the Academy to vote on the Oscars. And you are not a member of the Academy, dear sir. I hate to inform you of that.
I get all of the viewers.
From SAG.
They get it from the Academy.
You are not a member of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, sir. I hate to tell you that. You have to get accepted to that, and not everybody, not even every actor who you've seen in famous films is in that. There are a lot of people in it, but just because you're a member of the union does not mean you're a member of the Motion Picture Academy. You do not vote for Oscars, sir.
Check in the actors category. I would check into that.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're on.
Okay.
I'll throw next week's pizza on it.
There goes next week's deposit.
Well, that's true. That's true.
So my point.
Yes.
Is that you're voting for Best Picture based on your own
criteria. Kind of whatever you make up for what you
exactly
think Best Picture is.
Yeah. Okay. Not for who gave the best performance, because that's one thing.
Well, that's an
accolade. Who gave the best performance, even though that is often not necessarily for the best performance. It's one for popularity. It's one for making a statement. It's not always the best, whether it's performance, whether it's cinematography, whether it's directing, whether it's a lot of what do they call it when they issue the odds on the sports books? What do they go through? A lot of I forgot what the word is now, where they decide which teams get what points or what over or under.
Like a sports book?
Yeah. And but they determine on I forgot what the, but this, it also happens in the Academy Awards. And not always the person who gives the best performance gets the best performance. Not always the best director gets the best director.
Sure, it's a popularity contest. Yeah,
well, it's more than that, because of a popularity contest, the same people would win it every year. So, but the best picture over the years, I think they've been losing viewership because people don't think that their movie gets a fair shake.
Well,
and that being the movie that has garnered the biggest box office, which means right. The most people have spent the most money on it.
Sure.
So it's the most popular.
Except for Titanic and Forrest Gump, I cannot think of, you know, those are two insanely popular movies that won the award. But it's a very
as far
rare
as the
thing.
Box office.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Right.
But it's extremely
exactly.
rare.
Exactly.
That's for sure.
Exactly. Now, have good movies won Best Picture? Well, yeah.
Well, they're always good. They're just the best movies tend to be smaller films that just aren't the wide release. Action movies. And,
well, I mean, like Lawrence of Arabia. Do you ever see that?
No.
Oh, all right. Gonna have to make you give you an assignment. Seriously, Lawrence of Arabia.
Okay.
You need to see it. One Best Picture, a fantastic movie. Beautifully panoramic, great acting, great storytelling, great cinematography, just a great musical score, a best picture.
Yeah.
Overall, okay?
Did it win?
Yeah, it did.
So there you go.
So, but again, it's may not have won the most money that year or earned the most money at the box office. I'd have to look that up.
It was a huge, huge hit, wasn't it?
It was a huge hit, but it may not have been the biggest hit for that year.
But even this one wasn't going to be, even this new category was not going to be just based on biggest box office, right? I mean, that's the funny thing is they didn't announce the criteria. I doubt they would have said whoever, you know, it's not an outright like scoring title, like a home run derby that whoever,
right.
So they were still going to have some way you had to vote on this, which really, if they do bring this back in another year, it's going to be very weird.
And who would be allowed to vote on that one? If it's the most popular,
would
you think the public...
I would think that would still be open to the whole... Oh, yeah, boy, that really gets you into a weird thing where you
start
doing that. That's the People's Choice Awards.
Right, that's exactly right.
That's not an Oscar. That would be really watering the whole thing.
Exactly. But I think enough people from the Academy and from the other divisions probably said, "What are you nuts?" I think they probably did that.
Or Disney said, "Hey, we don't want to ruin our chances on our guy winning Best Picture, so let's just scrap that this year." That would be the more kind of weird thing. I want some investigative reporting on that. Like, how are these decisions being made?
Well, then you need to send me out to Hollywood.
Coming up, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. We'll get to the news here in just a minute. Matt Bobala with you here, 720 WGN. Little John Mellencamp to get you going this morning at 4:13 a.m. Roger.
Hello.
Membership in the Academy is
you have to be sponsored by
only.
Two individuals.
Stop it now. Don't act like you know all this, because a minute ago you thought you were voting on the Oscars.
I thought I was.
Membership in the Academy is by invitation only. Invitation comes from the Board of Governors. Membership eligibility may be achieved by earning a competitive Oscar nomination or by the sponsorship of two current Academy members from the same branch to which the candidate seeks admission. But you have been voting on the SAGs, and those are fun awards, too.
Yeah,
so
don't
discredit yourself.
And we do get free viewers.
You get screeners.
Yeah.
And but if you're a member of the Academy in L.A., it says members get to see many new films for free at the Samuel Goldwyn Theater and other facilities within 2 weeks of their debut, and sometimes before release.
Yeah, we do get that here also.
At the screening
room? Not like sent home screeners. There are theaters where we can use our SAG-AFTRA membership for reduced cost, whatever, to get in to see certain movies and stuff.
That's cool.
So, yeah.
Well,
I'm going to forgive you
the $100 million bet.
Yeah, well, thank God we didn't shake on it.
You can put that in your Disney bank account.
The Disney bank account stays in the bank.
All right, you've heard us talking about, over the past few months, it's been a little while, but we talked about what happened, I think it was over a year ago now, 2 years ago, almost, in Cuba at our embassy, workers that were stricken with some mysterious illness.
Mm-hmm.
Was it psychological warfare? What was going on? Was it some sort of sonic warfare? Our friend Robert Bartholomew was talking to us back then, has talked to us about it over the months and years, about whether something happened there or not, or was it a form of mass hysteria? Robert's back on the phone with us. Good morning, sir.
Greetings from New Zealand.
How is New Zealand this time of year?
We're going into the warmer weather right now, but it's still pretty cool outside. Cool is like 60 degrees during the day, so it's a very different definition of cool than in Chicago.
Well, and it's actually been about 60 degrees here, which is kind of cool for us. We've coming off some heat this week and coming back into some cool, and I'm forgetting. So that's right. So you're headed towards summertime now in New Zealand, correct?
That's right. And right now, probably half of all New Zealanders are watching television because there's a big rugby match between Australia and New Zealand right now.
Oh,
and
really?
It's rugby league, yes. I'm not watching it. I'm one of the other 50%.
You have not converted yet in your life in New Zealand to being an avid rugby fan?
Well, we do get the NFL here, and we get the college football. So I really enjoy the college football and the NFL. I grew up with it, so it's what you're used to, isn't it?
But is it hard for you to watch it? Are they showing it on delay so it's at normal times there, or are you having to get up late at night or early in the morning to see those games?
Yeah, that's true, like 4 in the morning for some of these games. You know what's really interesting? When you watch something, this is cultural, when you watch something like, for example, Australian rules football or the rugby league in New Zealand, the way they play rugby, it just looks like it's mass chaos and everybody's cheating all the time on every play and they're pushing them and all this
right.
stuff. And then after you've watched it a couple of times, you understand the rules and you understand what's going on. I mean, sometimes before some of these Australian rules games, they're actually like punching each other and elbowing them really hard, knocking them around, and that's considered legal.
And that's just part of the rules that's okay to do.
Yeah, it's different.
It sounds like it. It sounds like it. Well, it's good to talk to you again, and I'm really curious if you've seen this article that was in the New York Times on September 1st. The headline said, "Microwave weapons are prime suspect in ills of U.S. embassy workers."
Yes, I did. I saw that article. And what's interesting is I'm on my fourth publication. I published in four science journals on this, and I keep updating it with the latest news.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want to emphasize is, you know, this is the case that just won't die.
Right.
But what I want to emphasize is that there's always rogue scientists out there that believe in Bigfoot or space aliens or this or that. I'm a mainstream scientist. You know, I'm not out there on a limb.
Right.
And the last time you had me on, I criticized the JAMA article, the Journal of the American Medical Association, which
right.
is probably the second-ranked medical journal in the world. And they had come out with this study which said it appears that there are concussion-like symptoms and white matter tract changes to the brain. And when you actually look at the data, that's not the case. They had overstretched the limitations of the data, and they had speculated. And I can tell you, I was not the only one. There were a number of people, that neurologists, who were highly critical of that article. And I think the only reason that article ever got published and accepted for publication was because of the topic. And it's such an important and interesting topic that's going on right now. But when it actually came out, there was a commentary and there was an editorial in that journal where they really beat it up. It was savaged. And then since then, they published an article, a letter by myself and several other scientists sharply criticizing the study. Now, there's a reason why I'm bringing up the study. It's because the New York Times article, and you would know this, journalists are always looking for another angle. So what they did was they interviewed Dr. Douglas Smith, who was one of the main members of the research team that published the original article in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And he speculated that, well, it could be microwaves as well. Well, it could be just about anything, I suppose. I mean, it's just speculation, but there's no evidence for this. And what I find fascinating is when the JAMA article appeared, there was not a single word in their study about microwaves. They looked at the possibility of sonic weapons and the concussion-like symptoms and the white matter tract changes. And, of course, white matter tract changes are common in everything from depression to dementia to normal aging. And the concussion-like symptoms, there's no structural changes to the brain when you look at the scans. I mean, and it's all open to interpretation. And that's what these scientists who were critical of the study were pointing out. It's kind of like you see what you expect to see. So the fact that they interviewed one of the members of this study that has been discredited at this point, or let's just say the evidence certainly isn't there, and I think it was somewhat embarrassing that they came out and made the claim. It's not that they did the study. It's not that they had this data. It's that they overstepped the limitations of the data that they had and were making, they were in the bounds of speculation there. So I think they were embarrassed by that. And then so the Times is looking for another angle, so they interview him, and he says, well, it could be microwave weapons. The problem with microwave weapons is you would have to have an antenna, something on the size of an antenna at a major airport, and it would have to be very close to the person. And then you think to yourself, well, maybe somebody has erected something like this, and they pointed it at the U.S. Embassy in Cuba. Okay, fine. But here's the thing, and a lot of people don't realize this. It didn't happen at the U.S. Embassy in Cuba. It happened to staff members of the U.S. Embassy, either in their homes or in one of the two major hotels in Havana. These are massive buildings. And they were deep inside the buildings when these supposed attacks took place. And to think that somebody could be targeted deep inside one of those two massive hotels or in your own home, it's just, is it possible? Yes, it's possible. Someone has spent millions of dollars to erect some type of secretive antenna, but it's just very, very implausible. And it just doesn't make sense. The only explanation at this point that makes sense to me is the conventional science one, which is mass psychogenic illness, mass hysteria.
But in a scientific paper that same month, James C. Lynn of the University of Illinois, a leading investigator of the Frye effect, described the diplomatic ills as plausibly arising from microwave beams. Dr. Lynn is the editor-in-chief of Bioelectromagnetics, a peer-reviewed journal that explores the effects of radio waves and electromagnetic fields on living things. In his paper, he said high-intensity beams of microwaves could have caused the diplomats to experience not just loud noises, but nausea, headaches, and vertigo, as well as possible brain tissue injury. The beams, he added, could be fired covertly, hitting only the intended target.
But it's all speculation. Where's the data? They don't have the data.
Clearly,
it is all
speculation.
You can speculate on all sorts of things.
Absolutely. But there are people out there. I mean, I don't know who this guy is. I'm trusting the New York Times is finding people that make sense to interview. But, you know, when you and I first talked, you know, you said, we know of no, we don't know of any of this that's being built or any testing or anything like this. And now it sounds like we're hearing, well, they have tested these things. They have looked into these types of things. You know, we had talked about sonic and audio things back then, but now they're talking about microwave. So it's different. But do you think that this is all still easily dismissible? Or are you now more on, hey, show me some data or else let's just quit talking about this? Because it is, like you said, it's just speculation at this point that, hey, it could be this, hey, it could be that. And they mention, you know, they do mention strikes with microwaves. Some experts now argue more plausibly explain reports of painful sounds, ills, and traumas than do other possible culprits, sonic attacks, viral infections, and contagious anxiety, which I'm guessing is another term for mass hysteria, right?
Yes. You know, if you scour the internet, you'll find a lot of claims about the military engaging in secret experiments with, sure, microwave weapons and all sorts of weapons. Not long ago, the science journal Nature published a review on the progress of the development of microwave weapons. I know this because I've been researching this for another article that I'm writing. And it concluded that despite 50 years of research on high-powered microwaves, the U.S. military, has yet to produce a usable weapon. And the title of their article, of the research, was, the review of the research, was Wasted Energy. If they have usable microwave weapons or sonic weapons, why the hell didn't they use them in Iraq? Why don't they use them in Syria? They don't, and people die because these weapons are, you know, the other thing that gets me is the when we criticize, myself and other scientists criticize the JAMA study, and they published our correspondence in the Journal of American Medical Association recently, the researchers came out and said, well, there's stuff that we can't tell you about, because we got the information from the government and we're working with the U.S. government. Okay, fine. But that's a problem. That's a giant red flag. You can't reach into your back pocket and pull out the, well, we know stuff that we can't report on card. You can't do that. And the other thing I want to say is when they published their article, and this is absolutely true, and nobody can dispute what I'm going to say. When they published their research in the Journal of the American Medical Association, probably the second most respected journal in the world for medicine, they got it wrong. What they described as mass hysteria, they talked about malingering and collusion. That they totally and completely misunderstood the literature. They did not understand the literature. And they're asking us to trust them when they have, and these are reputable scientists, they have not taken the time to read, research, and fully understand the literature. That's why, you know, I know somebody who has contacted me, a top neurologist, who said, you know, the Journal of the American Medical Association had me review that article, and I rejected it, but they decided to publish it anyway. And the problem is, you know, I grew up as a journalist. I started my career in journalism in 1977 as a radio journalist in upstate New York. And you're always looking for another angle. And that's what this is. There's kind of a lapse now, and now that you're looking for another angle on the story, now it's the speculation about microwaves. Mm-hmm. I think that this case will finally be solved, but it's not going to be solved until we get the Freedom of Information Act documents, which I've applied for and I'm still waiting for them, and then we can see the early correspondence and how this whole thing developed and what's really going on behind the scenes. Because it doesn't look like to me that we're getting the whole picture here.
So what's your guess going to be, Robert, that this is just mass hysteria, but people want to make more of it because it's Cuba and because it's advantageous? Or is it going to be the government's not revealing everything and maybe something more is going on here?
Well, if the government's not revealing, I don't think that they've got some secret microwave weapon out there. I don't think that's it. As I've said in the past, this case can be summed up in a single sentence. When you hear the sound of hoofbeats in the night, first think horses, not zebras. I mean, the first few people started to become ill, and they said they heard popping noises in their ears and stuff like this. Members of the State Department doctors, because this was in the testimony in the Marco Rubio Senate hearings and last January, they said, we immediately assumed that it was some type of sonic attack. Really, there's a lot of other plausible explanations that could have been other than some type of sonic attack. And then what they did was, after that small number were affected, they started counseling people who were going to Cuba, telling them, look, we think staff members at the embassy may have been the subject of a sonic attack, and that you should be aware of this, and these are some of the symptoms, and you may hear a noise. Well,
once
people going over there,
sure.
it's mass suggestion, isn't it? And then the people who did the JAMA study said, well, yes, but some of the people weren't even aware that this was going on. Well, but when you look at the data, they didn't start interviewing these people until, on average, 203 days after they reported having the symptoms. And human memory is very fallible, and you can easily get things confused. And, of course, everybody would have been talking about this at the time, I'm sure, because if somebody said to you, oh, you're going over there, there might be some sonic attack you might be the subject of, I mean, it's going to be the buzz of the embassy.
Yeah. So, in the end, Robert Bartholomew still believes that way more likely that this is more just something happened, people talked about it, it gets kind of put into your head, and this is just a form of mass hysteria. You're not believing that there are microwave weapons that have been developed to the point that we are just selectively aiming them at U.S. embassy workers and not unleashing them on the rest of the world if they have that technology.
Yeah. On the weight of evidence, at this time, mass psychogenic illness hypothesis is the best explanation given the data that I have seen. But I'm going to make a prediction.
Okay.
The United States, well, we've had what? We had the State Department episode in with the embassy in Cuba. Now there's 25 people that have been affected. And then you had, after that happened, you had several dozen American tourists who had visited Cuba over the past 5 years who reported to the Associated Press that they stayed in one of those two hotels, heard strange noises, and felt unwell as well. Mm-hmm. Then you had a couple of diplomats in Uzbekistan report hearing some unusual noises and feeling unwell. And then a few months ago, you had several diplomats in China, American diplomatic staff, saying that they felt unwell and heard strange noises at the same time. Or at least within an hour of feeling unwell. The United States has nearly 300 physical embassies and consulates and diplomatic missions around the world with thousands of workers, everywhere from Afghanistan to Zimbabwe. And right now, all the staff are on the lookout for strange sounds and vague feelings of unwellness. This is a classic mass suggestion, mass hysteria setup. I would suggest to you that the groundwork has been laid for more so-called attacks by mass suggestion. And I think this is just going to go on and on until we get the FOI documents.
And with that, you'll have enough data to say, look at this. Look at how this – you'll see the timeline a little more on how things happen and be able to paint a clearer picture of how mass suggestion just worked out in this case.
And what was going on behind the scenes and what people were really saying as opposed to what they're reporting in the news. I've investigated several mysterious illness outbreaks, and when I got the Freedom of Information Act documents, it didn't take long to figure out what was going on and what people were reporting publicly and then what was really going on behind the scenes and what they're saying privately. So it'll be interesting. These things take time, and as I've said before, the wheels of progress in America and in science move slowly.
Yeah.
But they move, and we will eventually figure out what's happened.
In the meantime, Robert, you know how you start nipping this in the bud?
How?
Anonymous op-ed to the New York Times. You are the adult in the room, straightening us out, letting us know it's just mass hysteria. Chill out. Maybe that's been done already.
That's a good one.
I've been waiting all night for that one for you, Robert. Robert Bartholomew, our friend in New Zealand, we will check in with you again. I always appreciate you jumping on the phone. Stay out of trouble and enjoy the rugby game today.
Okay, I've got it on tape now. have a good morning.
All right, sir, we'll talk to you again soon. Robert Bartholomew, our friend in New Zealand. It is a fascinating story, but Robert's sticking by his guns, saying, listen, got to look a little deeper. Don't just read the words that are on the printed page, but think about everything going on here. We're not hearing anything that says this truly is. It's just speculation and, people grasping at, well, how could this have happened? Nobody wants to just accept. And you can understand people don't want to just accept. It's all in your heads. They want to know that there's a villain out there causing these problems. Hey, everybody. Matt Bubal here with you, 720 WGN. Rog, real quick, you got to help me out with this because I got a live read for GNTV. Okay. But I think that the information has changed.
Well, it depends. The night game is still at 6:05.
See, that's not what I heard. I think the Cubs announced on Twitter that the first game's at 2.
2:05.
Mm-hmm. And then they said the second game will be 45 minutes later.
Oh, that's very possible. That they usually do that with a doubleheader. I didn't think about that. Let me double check.
Well, not always, because sometimes they do the whole day-night doubleheader because they want everybody to have to use their tickets because they don't want to lose any cash.
Would you like me to look that up?
Yes, please do so, because I'm about to say teenage rivals, National League MVPs. It's Bryant versus Harper in primetime Cubs-Nets tonight at 6 on WGN-TV. But the Cubs tweeted out 5 hours ago, tonight's game has been postponed. We'll play a doubleheader tomorrow beginning at 2:05. The second game will begin 45 minutes after the first game concludes.
Okay.
So I don't know what that
according
means.
According to Major League Baseball, Major League Baseball has the Cubs' first game 2:05 and the nightcap at 6:05. And that's from Major League Baseball's website.
Well, I guess the assumption is 3 hour game, 45 minutes later, it's still going to be 6 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'm assuming that the Cubs are going to be on at 6 o'clock on GNTV, but because that's all up in the air because of that, I don't know. But this is what it says. Mm-hmm. Cubs, Nationals tonight, 6:05 p.m. on WGNTV. I'm not sure where the 2:05 game will be played, if they'll carry both or if one will be on one channel, one on another. I don't know how they do all that.
Hold on.
Above my pay grade. Poor Michael Kopech for the White Sox.
Can you believe that?
It's terrible. I do feel bad. I'm not a Sox fan. I just grew up a Cubs fan, but my mother-in-law and a lot of my in-laws are huge Sox fans, and you did love seeing what the Sox are kind of doing with the Cubs did a few years ago. They're tearing it down and building it up, and they've got all these great pieces coming along, and here's this guy who was throwing it pretty lights out, you know, having his rookie struggles too, but you saw the future, and now he's not going to be back till 2020, they're saying.
Yeah, out all of next year with Tommy John surgery. And he never really, I mean, he showed some kind of sparkle in the times he's been out.
He never got much of a chance. He kept getting rained out every time he pitched.
Every time he pitched, there was a rain out.
Yeah.
It's a game delay, and they didn't want to bring him back.
Yeah, and this time they did.
Right.
And not so good. And I don't know if that's the issue. Probably not, but that's just terrible for Sox fans. All right, quick break. More to come. 312-981-7200, 720 WGN. 4:48 in the morning, 720 WGN. We've got Orion coming up with the morning show in a little bit here. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Texter asked me if I'm ready for the new iPhone unveiling on Wednesday. Apple's got their big product launch coming up this week. We've got the Bob Woodward book finally coming out. So there'll be a lot of stuff in the news. Apple stock just kept going through the roof, Raj.
Yeah.
We've been talking about how they crashed through the $1 trillion mark.
A couple of weeks ago.
Almost probably a month ago now.
A month now, yeah.
Got up to $1.1 trillion. They had about $103 million. They had a 52-week high is $229.67. Finally, some profit takers came in this week. It went back down to 221. So it lost a decent amount, but it has been on just a ridiculous
tear. Do you know when was the last time it split? It hasn't split in a long time.
It split 7-1 like 5 years ago.
I think. It's been a while. Okay.
It's been a decent amount of time. Yeah. And it was a 7-1 split. It was a big split. Amazon has still never split. Those shares are at $1,952 per share.
Why hasn't it split?
I don't know. Some stocks don't care to do it.
Oh, okay.
Some do it because, and I think Apple cited when they did the 7-1 split that, you know, when I see, so if let's say Apple was $10 a share and I thought, boy, that's a great stock.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe I'll buy 200 shares, $2,000, right?
Right.
But I see Amazon for almost $2,000 a share. I'm like, well, I'm not going to buy one share of that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's a psychological thing that sometimes you're willing to let's split it down just because more people are more likely to say, oh, I'll throw some money into that.
Sure, sure.
But Amazon appears not to care. They reached a trillion earlier this week and then gave it back. So they are now, what's Amazon?
Just under.
$952 billion. They came considerably back.
Yeah.
They lost about $50 billion since they hit that. There, it's so interesting, though, like I've talked about the price-to-earnings ratio, so how much a company makes versus what it's selling at.
Mm-hmm.
And usually, a really speculative company is a really high price-to-earnings ratio, and a old-time, more traditional, say, company is going to be much lower. So like GE, who's struggling, their PE is 28. AT&T's price-to-earnings ratio is 6.28, so it's very low. McDonald's price-to-earnings is 24. IBM's is at 23. Coca-Cola is really high right now. It's at 81 times earnings, so that's really high. Amazon and their huge stock price and valuation is trading at 154 times earnings. So that's a high speculation there. And that's what makes me nervous about jumping into that stock.
Right.
Apple, even though it's valued at over $1 trillion now and went on a huge run this week, the PE is only at 20. So it's still.
That's kind of low.
All right. Let's take one more quick break, and then we'll get ready to say hi to Orion in just a few minutes here on 720 WGN. Thanks for hanging out with us again this morning, everybody. 312-981-7200 is always the phone number and the text in line here at WGN Radio. We'll be back actually in 2 weeks. I've got to be off next weekend for business, but I'll be back after that. This Sunday morning, before we head out to Lambeau to see the Bears play the Packers, I'll be hanging out at our Little League Challenger Jamboree. They have a great division in Little League called Challenger, and it's for kids with special needs. And a lot of kids with Down syndrome and autism and other special needs are never going to get a chance to play Little League Baseball or play just regular old baseball in the way that most of our kids have gotten to enjoy it over the years. This Challenger League enables kids with special needs to team up with a buddy who help them hit and run and throw and enjoy all the things that we love so much about Little League. And what's really awesome about that is to see their parents get to be out on the sidelines watching their kids out on the field doing things that they never get to really see them do and enjoy the game of baseball the way we all take for granted. So the Little League Challenger Jamboree hosted by District 13 out at our Tri-Cities Little League fields at Randall Oaks in West Dundee off of Randall Road, taking place 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. this Sunday. The kids will be playing baseball. There's golf and hay rides and face painting and crafts and a DJ and food. The Knights of Columbus come out and they make that corn that they roast themselves and then dip in a ginormous vat of butter, and it's the most delicious thing ever. If you get a chance, you're out in the neighborhood, it's going to be a nice day on Sunday. Come hang out with us for a little while. We'd love to see you. Speaking of things out west, I think from live from Huntley, Illinois this morning, it's Orion Samuelson. Good morning, Big O.
Well, good morning to you, and I hear you're going to Lambeau.
I'm going to venture up to Lambeau. We're taking. I'm going to take Jack on Sunday for the Bears game because we got to see Lambeau Field one time here before the Bears
let
are playing.
Me tell you,
it's
let
warm.
Me tell you a quick story. I went to work in Green Bay at WBAY TV, the CBS station that carried NFL football in 1956. At that time, the Green Bay Packers were playing at the field of Green Bay East High School. It could seat 24,000, And it was all wooden planks, no seats at all, but wooden planks. You brought your own seat and clipped it on.
Okay.
So in 1956, they said, we have to have a new stadium. And for the stadium, since they were a CBS station, they brought in the Gunsmoke cast. Matt Dillon, or James Arness, and Doc and Kitty. And we had Richard Nixon, the vice president, Marilyn Vandenberg, Miss America, all there for the dedication of Lambeau Field. I've never forgotten it. I can still see James Arness climbing out of the back seat of a Ford Victoria that they drove on the field. He had to get down on his knees as he got out of the seat and then stand up because he was a big man. And I've never forgotten that. It was really quite an event. So I'm glad you're going back to see it.
Wow, I believe the stadium has changed quite a bit since back then, hasn't it?
Yes, it has changed a great deal. And, of course, you know, that team still owned by the citizen stockholders of Green Bay.
Right, so it's very, very unique in all of sports.
It really is. And I left there in 1960 just as God came to town. His name was Vince Lombardi. So